This is Dr. Richard Burrell. I'm continuing my oral interview with Mr. Pat Curry. Today is July 26, 2005, and we're in the same location again in the Special Collections Library Vietnam Archive Oral History Interview Room. It's around 3:15 Central Standard Time. Pat, why don't we continue with some discussion about your time there at Quang Hoi? I wanted to ask you if you could differentiate between the role, as you saw it, in your MOS, but also in general, the difference between the XO and his or her responsibilities, at that time, his responsibilities, and, at least in your branch, and the commander of the company, and how that relationship worked, responsibilities, and then how the two interacted.
Well, there's not really a firm model for saying, here's the responsibilities of the executive officer. It's pretty much up to the commander. The commander, of course, is responsible for everything, and in charge of, in command of everything. The commander is responsible for overall accomplishing the mission, and everything he does or she does should be focused on that objective. You know, what's the mission, and what's the best thing to do to accomplish that mission in the best way possible? And that includes making sure that the guys are working on the right thing. It includes making sure that they're doing it right. If you see the distinction I'm doing, I'm making that, you know, you got to do the right things and you have to do them right.
Right.
And so, kind of that overall kind of guidance is the commander's responsibility. military justice is totally the commander's responsibility and may not be delegated. Not that you would want to, but you can, even if you do.
Right.
A lot of times, to back up, the XO's role is whatever the company commander wants it to be. Many times, the XO is responsible for a lot of the administration, oversees personnel, does those kinds of things, tries to take some of the administrative burden off the commander, to free the commander up for more directly relevant things. Pardon me.
That sounds okay.
A lot of times the XO will also be responsible for what we call organizational maintenance, and that is maintenance of your own unit's equipment. In a direct support maintenance unit like I commanded, B Company, we were responsible for doing repairs to our customer unit's equipment. But that was a higher level repair, replacing an engine, replacing a transmission, something like that. Every unit is responsible for maintaining its own equipment at a lower level, and that's called organizational maintenance. Maintenance units have a lot of equipment, and they're no different. They have to take care of it. A lot of times the XO is responsible for that. In a maintenance unit, your company XO is also your shop officer, which means that he controls the flow of equipment through the repair process. He manages that through the repair process.
Is that usually hands-on, or is that done with basically the section heads reporting to him?
It is done with the section heads reporting to him.
Okay.
One of his jobs is to prioritize. And so he'll be telling, for instance, the armament repair shop, I want you to do this howitzer first. You always do howitzers first.
Why?
Because they're such a high-priority weapon.
They
were so important in direct support of the infantry units. I mean, that was one of their main support weapons. And each battalion had its own battery of 105s. And they usually had one extra, one float, they called it. But if one went down, you jumped on it immediately. And we used to carry a big stock of repair parts per howitzer so we could turn them around real quickly. Well, they're important enough that I mentioned the other day, flew to Benoit, picked up a sight, and flew out.
Right.
I mean, that's important.
Oh, yeah.
And, in a maintenance unit, the XO will also be the shop officer. Of course, company commander always is watching and making sure that it's going the way he wants. One of the company commander's big jobs is liaison with the customers. are the customer units getting what they need from your unit? What do we need to do it better? Do we have the priorities right? Do our priorities match yours? You know, do you want us to do that 81 millimeter mortar next, or do you want us to do the 106 recoilless rifle next?
And that's the call of that commander, basically that middle rank tier, the company commander in the field, I guess, making that request?
Oh, no, we would deal, the company commanders in the field, we hardly ever, is a support unit. We never talked to the infantry company commanders. They were out in the jungle. We would talk to the battalion rear. The S4 is the section that's responsible for logistics. Mm-hmm. And we would talk to them. They had a battalion maintenance section. We would talk to them or their S4, okay, maybe their battalion XO, the major, mm-hmm, and see, you know, were they satisfied with what they were getting. If they were having a problem, the XO would call me and say, hey, I need this. And if it's important enough for battalion XO to call you, usually kind of hustle right on to get it, yeah, done. Yeah.
So it is that it's not the generals and it's not necessarily the colonels. It's the majors and the captains and lieutenants who are making these decisions and communicating back and forth about what's priority, what you need, and when you need it, and are you all meeting each other's needs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the big things that I did was as a company commander was go around and visit all the customers as often as I could.
How many would you say?
A dozen, 15. You know, it varied depending on who was coming through the area. And in theory, we would support a specific brigade, but they would take a battalion and attach it to the brigade, and we'd pick up support for them. They'd take one of our battalions and attach it to another brigade, and we'd drop support for them. And back and forth, so it varied.
Okay. Which role did you prefer? I know probably commander.
No question about it. You know, there's they always joke about a major, you know, it's the worst rank in the Army, you're not eligible to command anything. And that's not strictly true. There are some major command positions, but not many. Because, you know, the major can't command, so it's a terrible rank.
You're stuck in the middle.
You're stuck. And, but, yeah, no, commander is always the best job.
Could you tell me what you remember about what was the most common piece of equipment that you all were servicing?
Radios. The electronics had a lot of trouble with the dust.
Mm-hmm. How about the humidity and the water? Was that a problem for radios?
Not so much the water. Humidity, yeah. It would corrode things and short-circuit things and et cetera. They usually tried to... The radios that were actually out in the weather, the backpack-type radios, were pretty well protected. It was I'm trying to think of the word for it here, but the station mount, the centrally located radios that we had a lot of trouble with. And of course, they're pretty high priority, communications and et cetera. And if you have one mounted on a Jeep and you start the Jeep with the radio on, there's a good chance that a power surge will fry the radio. And they could never, at that time, been a filter that was fast enough to catch that transient spike. And so we used to get radios that have been fried for that reason, but more often it was dust and humidity that was causing problems. And, I mean, they ran 24/7.
Yeah.
And so.
What about after radios? What do you think?
Probably weapons. Not so much M16s, because most of those could be fixed. Most of the things that would go wrong with an M16 could be fixed at organizational maintenance at the unit level. Couldn't you turn it in requisition and do it? And it go back to depot and be fixed back there where it'd be scrapped.
Did you all have to deal with the jamming problem? This is basically that had been solved by the time you arrived.
That's correct. No, we did not have to deal with it.
Okay.
One of the things we did have to deal with at that time was guys used to like to take two clips and tape them together. Well, at that time, the spring in the M16 that held the clip in place wasn't strong enough to hold the weight of two full clips.
Right.
And this was before the banana clips and et cetera. And So it would eventually wear or break that spring. We'd have to go in and replace that. That was a problem.
How much did you know how to repair a lot of this stuff yourself, or did you left it to your specialist, obviously?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't know how to fix much of it myself. That really wasn't my job.
Right, of course.
You know, I used to go out there once in a while and try to get down and have one of them teach me something. Mm-hmm. Just for the interaction. And it was kind of interesting, you know. But in terms of replacing an engine or something like that, no, I didn't know how to do that. Now, I knew how to, at organizational level, I know how to inspect a vehicle.
Right.
To see if it's being maintained, if the driver's doing what he should do, if the motor pool's doing what they should do, those kinds of things. So I know what's wrong. I'm not sure I can fix it.
Right. How big of an operation was Quanloy? I mean, your responsibility there for the shop, and then you're the commander. What are we talking about? You know, two buildings, one giant warehouse, or estimate?
My company?
Yes.
We had about four hooches that were barracks. They were kind of long and low, just one-story jobs. They had bunkers in between. The NCOs had a separate hooch where they stayed. We had a fairly sizable, by Quanloy standards, warehouse. It was a two-story building. We had a kind of a metal-type shed that was a vehicle maintenance facility. Had a couple of bays in it. We had an electronics repair shop that was essentially two mobile units that had been put together and taken off the wheels. Mm-hmm. If we were ever to move, then we would put them back on the wheels and they'd moved with us. And we had a separate armament repair shop. It was basically the same kind of facility. We had a little headquarters building. It had the company offices in the front, the officers' quarters in the back.
Okay.
And that was, oh, and we had a little company club, just a little bit of things.
Were all these buildings air conditioned?
Oh, no, none of them were air conditioned. No. The only time, I don't remember seeing air conditioning. I guess when I went back to Benoit and went to the club, I guess the club was air conditioned. Had a nice club.
How did you guys acclimatize?
Was it difficult? Not really. You got used to it. It was a lot harder getting used to wearing the steel pot than it was getting used to the helmet, because until you'd worn it for a couple of weeks every day, and that's all you wore in the cap was steel pot. You never wore a soft cap.
You were required to wear it all the time?
All the time. And you also had to carry the weapon anytime you went outside your company area.
Okay.
Now, this was in Quanloy.
Right.
At Benoit, while I was there, they turned in their weapons and put them in Connexes, so they didn't carry them. But if you wear that steel pot until you got used to it, boy, it really gets your neck. But no, we were all so young that acclimatizing really wasn't difficult.
Okay. We were looking before we started recording at the map here. We have a map of Southeast Asia, close up to Vietnam, South Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, North Vietnam, Thailand. We were looking at Quanloy, and it is located just outside Phan Lok, and it's almost due north of Saigon, or Ho Chi Minh City today. How often did you get into Phan Lok? You said it was off limits, or were you guys
I never even saw Phan Lok, other than flying over it in a helicopter. My guys that drove, the convoys used to come through there. They'd have to go down and pick up a load of repair parts or something like that, bring it in. So they went through the village, and I'm not going to tell you that some of them did sneak into the village at times, but I never saw him.
Did you know for a fact that they were sneaking into the village and just kind of let that go?
I didn't know it at the time.
Okay.
And I would not have let it go.
Okay.
We had one guy, and his nickname was Weasel. He kept coming up with a case of VD, so I figured he was going into town somewhere.
He wasn't catching it from the M16.
He was preparing. And so I figured he had to be sneaking, and he was a driver.
Ah, okay.
So he had plenty of chances to.
Okay.
But I never did catch him.
Why weren't you all out off base? Was that just a cab regulation that you all followed, or was it more of a safety thing?
I think it was some of both. I'm not sure why, but I know that the restriction against going into Saigon was pretty rigidly enforced. Like I mentioned, that the MPs in Saigon would go around and look at the left shoulder
Right.
And if you had a faded spot, you know, around a calf patch, you would have gone to the provost marshal's office. But no, and it's kind of like the restriction on hooch mates. Almost all the other units had them, and we didn't. I think it was part of being, you know, a combat unit, being a forward mind division, maintaining that kind of mindset, that kind of image.
You're right out there by the Cambodian border. Mm-hmm. You're just literally a few miles out from that. Mm-hmm. What did you know about operations in Cambodia? Did you know that anybody was over there, or that the enemy was using it as a sanctuary and we were trying to infiltrate? Or?
Well, we knew that that they were over there. I mean, that was just real obvious. There's no place else they could have been. We didn't really start getting a lot of stuff until after I left. My replacement as company commander was a guy named Tom Skinner. And Tom wrote me and told me they were, when we started the big operations, incursions into Cambodia, one of the things our company did was collect the weapons and stuff that had been captured and prepare them and retrograde them back to Myanmar, wherever they wanted us to send them. And he said there was just mountains of stuff coming through there. He said they were working 20 hours a day trying to process it and get it loaded and get it shipped out. There was just an amazing amount of stuff right across the border.
Were you all aware of how many of the enemy were around you? It might seem like a silly question, but...
No, it's not a silly question at all. And it's something that we used to wonder about. You know, how many of them are there out there watching us?
Right.
How many of them are there in here inside the perimeter watching us? After one ground attack, we found a there was an artillery battalion right across the street, 175s.
Mm-hmm.
And we found their barber hanging in the wire after a ground attack. He'd been one of the bad guys. And coming in, shaving the battery commander every day and all of that. And so, you know, you did wonder about that because it was so dense you couldn't see. Mm-hmm. They could have been 2 feet inside the tree line. We'd have never seen them. And then, you know, periodically get a big ground attack or something like that.
Mm-hmm. How many of those incidents happen?
Ground attacks?
Yeah.
Probably half a dozen or so.
Was this mainly at night, you said? Can you clarify that?
Yeah, almost always. Now, we got mortared, gosh, every couple of days. It might be at noon. One time we were having a company formation. And at noon, one of our regular formations, and all of a sudden mortar shells started coming in. I mean, they were way far away, and you get kind of callous, you know, to it, and you can tell by the sound how far or how close they are, and it didn't particularly bother me any, but I looked out there, and I could see a few deers in the headlights, or deer in the headlights, looks,
mm-hmm.
And so I thought, okay, and I just put them fall out, and they hooked it off and went into bunkers, so we got mortared probably every few days, but... And you can tell by how sharp the crack is,
mm-hmm.
how far away they are. Mm-hmm. But we probably got half a dozen pretty good-sized ground attacks.
Did you all feel confident out there that you could defend yourself adequately and handle yourself if the quote-unquote human wave attacks would come?
Well, you know, I don't know that we ever thought about human wave attacks. They really weren't. In the attacks that we did have, they really weren't that numerous. I'm not sure we were that confident we could keep every single one of them outside the wire. We never believed that they could actually take control of the base.
How large was that base?
And it was a brigade headquarters. So we had some aviation units. We had one time we had a troop of the 11th ACR there, and those poor guys. Wow. But
was it as large as the Texas Tech campus?
The
smaller?
Probably a little larger. We had an airfield.
Okay.
That C-130s used to land on. So that's big enough to have that. And we had the officers' club was an old French house, two-story, real nice. Had been real nice at one time. And there was a French plantation. If you go to the... If you Google Quamoy and look, you'll see pictures of an old French plantation with, just unbelievable, a huge swimming pool, These big stone columns at one end, this beautiful little bathhouse at the other end. I mean,
was it functional?
Not when I was there, but I found out from the website that later they cleaned it up and opened it up to the troops.
Wow.
And it looked beautiful in the pictures after it had been all cleaned up. But clearly it had been a very upscale, very nice place at one time. And it was right there inside the wire.
Right. So, let me ask you about, if you could comment on the flow of equipment and materials from the United States into Quang Boi. A long way, and I want to also ask a larger question about war and the effects upon the economy of the United States. But before that, how did equipment get to you all? I mean, did you know the steps then or now, looking at this, and from where it was manufactured in the United States, you know, shipped over or flown over, and then how it made its way? And I want people who are listening to this to kind of picture, as I am, I'm picturing the buildings with your equipment and shop and the work being done, and you saying, you know, we get these parts in. Well, are the parts coming in one at a time? Are they coming in a bin of things? How did that whole thing work?
Well, if we can break the world into two parts,
sure,
in that context, one is a complete item,
okay,
which is what we used to call class 7. Okay. It might be a rifle, it might be a tank, it might be a radio, it might be a truck, but it's a complete item that is ready to use.
Okay.
And that's a class 7 item. And no, at the time I had no clue, but after 20 plus years in logistics, I think I have a fair idea now. The Army Material Command in the States would be responsible for projecting how many of a given item that the Army was going to need. Totally, be it the Army in Europe, the Army in Southeast Asia, wherever, and for procuring those. And they would contract with civilian contractors to build a tank or build an M16 or build a radio, build a truck, whatever, build X number of them. And then they would send those out. Now, if we requisitioned something from Quang Boi, for instance, had a unit, their water buffalo got stolen. Okay, major crisis.
Yes.
I mean, it truly was. That poor company, XO, was panicked. He didn't know how he was going to keep water moving. And we took care of it. But so that we requisitioned, they requisitioned through us a new water buffalo. And that requisition went through the system and went back to Benoit or Long Bend Depot.
How long would that take?
For the requisition to get there?
Yes.
4 or 5 days.
Okay.
Don't forget, then, it's a lot of paper.
Yes.
You know, now it's all electronic, but back then it was a lot of paper. In multi-part forms.
And I think people lose sight of that. I think people lose sight that today it's all done electronically. Then you all had, you didn't even have photocopiers. You had the mimeographs. And you work with carbon paper, right? And so you're talking about a mountain of paperwork.
A mountain of paperwork.
For items. And I've heard other veterans who worked in the rear and worked action logistics about how much paper you had to keep up with.
Yep.
It was
unbelievable.
Yeah. So 4 to 5 days for that stuff to get...
That was just for the piece of paper to work its way through the system, go to our next level of supply. And did they have it there? No, not a water buffalo. Move back to the next level, eventually wind up, since it's a complete class 7 item at Long Bend Depot. Long Bend Depot processes the requisition, says, yes, we have one to fill this requisition. And they take it out of their storage, put it in the pipeline, in the supply pipeline. And it would go to a transportation unit for them to move forward.
And usually, what, C-130 would fly it out? Or?
Oh, no, it was all by land.
Really?
Yeah. And, I mean, those kinds of things.
Okay.
And so then it would go, the transportation unit would move it to a staging point where we would pick up our supplies from. We'd go back on a run to pick stuff up. It'd be there for us to pick up.
Pick up in a deuce and a half?
Well, we had a deuce and a half. We'd hitch it to the back of our deuce and a half. Hauled it up to Quang Boi, called the customer, said, it's here, come get it. And that essentially is how in real simple terms, how the resupply chain would work. Now, if it was a smaller item.
This class 7. That was a priority item, a water buffer. They needed water.
Yes.
They needed to have this piece of equipment. So are you talking about 10 days, maybe 7 days on average?
Not for a water buffer, though, because there's an Army system called MilStrip. Well, it's not an Army system. It's a DOD system, Department of Defense system. MilStrip. Are you ready? Acronym of the day. Military Standard Requisition and Issue Procedures. MilStrip.
Can you say that again slower for the transcription?
Sure. Military Standard Requisition and Issue Procedures.
Okay.
And MilStrip. And basically all the services use essentially the same system.
Mm-hmm.
But it would say for this type of item, the maximum priority that you can use is a 3.
I see.
Okay. For a howitzer, of course, you can use a 1A. For a water buffalo, you can use a 4. And that determined how fast it, to some extent, how fast it got processed.
Who coded it?
The unit did.
What if they miscoded it?
Then eventually the system would change it.
Okay. So
that really, it had some effect on how fast it was processed. The real effect was is if you didn't have any, how much effort the system put out to get some and get it to them.
Right.
So that if it is a priority 1A, there's a lot of people running around trying to find one to get to them. If it's a priority 4, as an example, then there might be one guy who's saying, well, this can wait until this next shipment that I already have on order comes in.
I'm trying to picture now the infantry company commander in the field who needs socks.
Mm-hmm.
What would that be graded? Would it be
a pretty low priority? Yeah.
But to him, he knows that, right?
Mm-hmm.
The infantry company commander knows it's a pretty low priority in the whole requisition system.
Yeah.
But for him, it's a high priority, mm-hmm, because his men need fresh socks.
Sure.
Let's just say, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells his battalion S4, or the assistant S4, this is high priority. I have, 7 or 10 of my men need a mal. The rest can go to the system. Does it matter at all?
Well, the clothing is kind of a bad example because they used to stock such massive quantities of that.
Okay, well,
that wasn't an issue. But maybe an example might be a radio.
Okay.
Such high demand, such high turnover, mm-hmm, that they might be out of stock on that. Whereas one backpack radio might not seem like a real high priority to somebody sitting in Virginia, it might be very high priority that come to command.
Right.
Now, there were methods to take care of things like this, systems. For instance, we had what we call a float. And what that was a stock of Class 7 items that I kept at my unit. If somebody had a very high priority requirement for one of these units, I could float them one, which means I gave them a new one, they gave me their broken one.
And do you then have to requisition another one, Class 7 item, for you to replace the one you had in float?
Depends. If I could fix it, I would fix it. Well, technically with float, if it couldn't be repaired, I wasn't allowed to float it.
Okay.
Because I was supposed to keep my float at a certain stock level, technically. If a guy out in out on a battalion fire base somewhere needs a howitzer and I have one in float, he's going to get it.
Okay.
I don't care if I can fix it or not, he's going to get it.
Right.
Hawk always back me up. Rules are great, but the guy in the field needed the howitzer a lot worse than I needed it sitting there so that my books were exactly straight.
Right.
We kind of operated on the it's easier to give forgiveness than permission theory, and so I say if they needed it, they got it.
So it, it seems that, that you and other mid-level officers who worked the system had a lot of autonomy to prioritize, to, like you said, if they need a howitzer, you're going to do whatever you can to get that thing out there, no matter if it messes up your float for a day or two, or if it, is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. And I think all the company commanders in our battalion were that way. I think they would absolutely, I wouldn't be on it, and just absolutely bust their butts to get the guys who were doing the fighting get up what they needed.
So, do you think that was an overall attitude in general in the Army? I mean, not just for your CAV unit, but do you know, do you have any idea?
You know, I really don't.
Okay. It's not much of a fair question.
I really don't. You know, as a lieutenant, I didn't have too much perspective on that. I knew if you wanted to work for General Hawk, you better have that attitude. I never had a problem with that, just my attitude anyway, maybe because I'd spent 6 months with the infantry.
Sure.
But, like I said, the other guys, the other company commanders had the same attitude. And they hadn't spent 6 months with the infantry, so I think it was, you know, that was our job. You know, they were the guys that were doing the fighting, and we owed it to them to do anything we could to get them what they needed. And if we had to bend the rule, then, now, the bending the rule thing got way out of control. Way out of control.
Are you referring to the barter system, the famous Vietnam barter system, or I guess maybe the military barter system, where you guys could exchange certain items? Hey, do you have
a... If you had a pallet of plywood, you could get anything you wanted.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
That would get out of hand?
That got way out of hand.
Tell me
about that. Way out of hand, and a lot of just, I mean, criminal or borderline criminal stuff went on too, and that's just, there's no justification for that. But in the distinction I'm drawing here, and I guess it's kind of situational ethics, but the distinction that I draw is that, you know, if it's an administrative thing, like keeping a float record straight, that's one side. And, you know, getting the guy what he needed far outweighed the administrative convenience.
Right.
Even though I understood the system, and technically the system was right, you needed to keep that float so that when the next guy came in, you had something for him. But still, you know, you solved the immediate problem. So, but the administrative side of it was one thing. The criminal side was another thing. They used to catch people driving out of Long Bend Depot with trailer loads of stuff with fake requisitions.
And what were they doing?
Sell it on the black market. Huge black market in Saigon.
Yes.
Not that I ever saw it, but huge black market there, and they could sell all this stuff on the black market.
Were you all made aware of this black market?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were told to watch for it pretty carefully, et cetera. So.
Can you give me examples of how it got out of hand? Besides the, or maybe what you meant by the plywood.
But oh, guys,
how did this thing get out of hand?
Guys in the rear would have, you know, a shipment of plywood would come in, and they would take pallets of it and trade it to other guys for their AK-47 so they'd have a war suit in the air.
And then falsify their records that they got it processed and sent it to such and such.
Such and such, yeah, so that their inventory would jive.
But somewhere along the line, that'll be caught, right?
Yeah, probably not. It wasn't.
I'm asking this.
You know, there's such massive amounts of material.
Right.
I mean, it's just huge. It's hard to envision the size of Long Bend Depot. I mean, it just went on and on and on and on and on. And a lot of times, they had no clue what they had out there. You know, so much stuff came in so fast that it just wasn't possible to keep it all organized and categorized and inventoried. And in that 1 year turnover that we talked about didn't help. About the time the guy figured out the inventory system, knew enough about it to make some real improvements, he went on.
Now that's interesting to contrast. Those infantry officers would say the same thing. As soon as I learned how to do things in the field, I was sent to the rear, or vice versa, I started in the rear, then I went to the field for 6 months, then I was home, you know, and there were problems. So even in the rear, that 1 year
sure.
rotation cause problems.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of danger, right. But it's a real technical job. And it's a pretty difficult job. I mean, think about managing the parts inventory for General Motors. You know, one of their big plants. Mm-hmm. Well, this was bigger than that.
Yes.
And it's not something you walk in and pick up in 24 hours.
It was much, much larger. We're talking about really millions and millions of tons of material.
Yes.
And I think that people might lose sight on the fact that, you know, how do you put on a war? How do you do a war? It's not just the people in the field. You've got to have, I think, one out of every seven men in Vietnam were rear in the rear, were, you know, supporting those in the field.
I'd be surprised if it went the other way around. One was fighting in six.
Oh, sorry. Yes, one was fighting. Yes, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
And so, putting on a war, especially by an industrialized country like the United States, and then especially like an industrialized country superpower like the United States, it's done in on a massive scale once the commitment is made. And your comments here, perhaps they will clarify. The question of, did we commit to Vietnam? Did we commit ourselves to South Vietnam? And logistically, what I hear you saying is absolutely.
Boy, we sure did. I mean, and the guys in the States were saying, we have to make sure they have everything they need. Everything. And if they might need it, we need to have it there on site. And they were shipping this stuff. Mm-hmm. And boy, here it comes. It's like trying to sip out of a fire hose. And this was not unique to Vietnam.
No.
Desert Storm was the same thing. I knew some guys that went over there, and same thing happened. So much stuff came in so fast that we used to have guys called MREs, Material Readiness Expediters, and they used to joke that that meant they were legal thieves. The depot, I say many times, didn't know what they had. And these guys were had badges. They were allowed access to the depot, them and their driver only. And they could go through the depot and look for things. Like if I needed a truck engine, and the depot said, we don't have any, these guys could go through the depot and look for a truck engine. When they found it, they would take a requisition and the location back. Hand the guy the requisition, he'd cut the release, they go pick up the engine and drive it out.
So they work on a special needs basis?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If I needed something real bad, like water buffalo.
Right.
I mentioned that. That's one of the things I called RMRE about. Need another lieutenant. And I just called him and said, hey, I need a water buffalo for whichever unit it was, first and seventh, whoever it was. Real bad.
Mm-hmm.
Can you look for me? He just takes this little blank requisitions, go down and drive through one of the depot, see if he can find a water buffalo. Wow. He did too. So,
would you say that the role of the system worked, the logistical system?
Maybe a little too well, in terms of putting so much stuff in the system that it couldn't be kept track of. But overall, I think it did work. Yeah,
okay.
I do. You know, I don't know of any instances of guys running out of bullets or guys running out of food. Those kinds of things. They might not have had dry socks every night, or very few nights, in fact. But if they needed bullets or needed food, something like that, it was the aviation units didn't run out of fuel. I don't recall waiting a long time for repair parts. You know, if it was a high priority requirement. And a little while ago, I made the distinction, divided the world into two parts.
Yes.
Class 7 is one part of this complete end item. The other side of the world is the repair parts. And the system works much the same, except you're dealing with individual items and a lot more of them, both in terms of the number of items and the number of each item, if you see the distinction I'm drawing. That's what I kept in my warehouse, was repair parts and some other supplies as well. So if first and seventh cab motor pool needed a Jeep carburetor, they would fill out a requisition, bring it to me. If I had one, I'd give it to them.
How many questions asked? No questions asked, or
no questions?
You had that requisition form. That's what you needed.
I had the requisition form. That's what I needed. and I gave him a Jeep carburetor. That's why I hit him.
Right.
And then I had a stock of Jeep carburetors, as an example. Mm-hmm. And maybe my stockage limit was 20. That's how many I was to keep on hand. And so then my resupply level was 12. So I'd issue out 8. When I got down to 12, I would order 8 more to bring me back up to 20. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that your inventory looked like a sawtooth. Mm-hmm. At least that's the theoretical model.
This is a question that I've asked others before, and I want to ask you the same one. And I've asked people mainly in the rear, and it has to do with, and it's a bit of counterfactual history, which is maybe not very relevant, but it might be, it might shed some light on what you saw and what you experienced is true. How much do you think modern computer technology, and this is in the year 2005, which we're talking, would have simplified or aided or hampered the process that you had in Vietnam? Or what kind of effects do you think that would have had?
Oh, I think it would have been immense. Just immense. You know, if we could have had, a lot of times items were shipped in Connex.
Right.
This is a 6x6x6 steel box. Also, at times, used as a jail cell. Not a comfortable one, but a jail cell. But anyway, if we could have had it come in, shoot a barcode, have the computer update the inventory, have the operator, and shoot back a location, have the operator take it to that location and put it in that location. I mean, think how much simpler that would have been. There would have been no pieces of paper to get lost.
It's almost like, or akin to the modern Federal Express or UPS shipping today.
Exactly. Exactly.
You can literally barcode stuff and track it.
Mm-hmm.
From origination to destination.
Exactly. Instead of filling out a long green piece of paper for a work order to get something repaired, you shoot that barcode and it fills out all the information for you.
What kind of effects do you think that would have had on the war effort in the field? It would have sped things up, I think.
It certainly would have sped things up. But I think the biggest savings probably would have been in time and money. Because we could have maintained a smaller inventory. Because we wouldn't have requisitioned 20 widgets because we didn't know we had 50 sitting over there.
Right.
And so it could have potentially saved an awful lot of time and an awful lot of money.
How frustrating was your job? Or how enjoyable was your job?
Oh, it was enormously enjoyable.
Why?
Just enormous. Tremendous sense of satisfaction. On an internal basis, had a good company. He had 95% good guys. Everybody's got their 10%. I think I had a little lower percentage than most. Just a good bunch of people that worked together well for the most part. And we had some incidents at the unit desk, but relatively few compared to some guys that were in the rear. We felt like we had a purpose and a mission, and they did it. I had very good relations with my customers. They knew if they needed something that we were going to do everything humanly possible to get it for them. And that we were not going to be bureaucrats and we were not going to, we were going to try to do it right, but we were going to get it for them. And so they said lots of good things about the company, the battalion commander, and XO and all of them, so that reflected well on us. And it was satisfying to go down there and to battalion headquarters and hear good things about the company. General Hawk had an internal inspection program. I mentioned he had high standards, and so he had an internal inspection program internal to the battalion where the battalion staff would descend upon you and inspect.
Not announced?
No, it was announced.
Okay.
And they'd look at your organizational maintenance, at your administration, at your inventory, how accurate was your inventory, all those kinds of things. And we did very well on those. One of the few companies that did do well they were known as just hellacious inspections.
And this was something indigenous just to Colonel Hawk?
Just to Colonel Hawk, yeah. And we did very well on those. So it was a real sense of accomplishment and a real sense of pride in what we were doing. And Hawk fostered that, you know, throughout the battalion, you know. And
you spell Hawk with an E on the end?
No, H-A-W-L-K.
Okay.
H-A-W-L-K.
Pat, let me ask you a larger question, kind of an overview type question. Being in logistics and seeing firsthand what the war effort is about when it comes to supply and how the, all the stuff moves from home, from the domestic scene, basically out, literally out to where the war is going on an individual basis out the field. What kind of overall effects do you think that a war has on the economy of the country fighting the war, and using the United States and Vietnam as an example? But based on what you saw, on the massive amounts of stuff coming in and out.
Well, I think it kind of came out towards the end and after the war, there was a lot of waste, but you know, I think it certainly created a huge deficit. The way Johnson funded the war was with deficits. And I think he kind of opened Pandora's box, and now we can't close it again.
In the sense that we still have the deficit, or in the sense that that's how we finance our foreign policy excursions?
Well, in the sense that's how we finance a lot of things. We got used to it, and we discovered that if you had a big deficit, it wouldn't come up this afternoon and bite you in the butt. You know, the fear of a deficit, I think, went away. And that's what I meant by open Pandora's box. We discovered that in terms of immediate short-term repercussions, maybe there weren't any real political repercussions. So people could get away with it, use the deficit to finance things in a home district, something like that. But I think it was really tough on the economy of the country in the long term. We still, in my opinion, have not recovered, not maybe from that specific deficit, but from the idea that deficit funding is an acceptable means of operating.
And I take it that you don't think it is.
Oh, I don't think it is. No. And I'm no different than everybody else. You know, don't go to my house. Cut the other guy's budget, not mine.
Right.
But we just are not able to make the hard decisions. I thought we had it under control until Iraq started and a couple other things, and then 9/11 kind of ended that for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take a break. Okay, Pat, continuing. Look, let me talk about Katina, your barracks, and your personal life there, and kind of logistically how you would function every day. Tell me about Quan Loi. You described the barracks briefly. Tell me about your mess hall and how you all ate, where your laboratory facilities were. Tell me about the bunkers you had to go into. What was that base like or living day to day?
It was very uncomfortable. It was just, I keep going back to hot and wet, but I mean, that's what it was. But I kind of mentioned our company area. It was kind of a little bit spread out. You wanted some dispersion for in case you got a mortar attack or an artillery attack, something like that. As far as the mess hall goes, we had a company cook, but we had a kind of community mess hall. And the cook, who was technically assigned to my company, worked in this community mess hall. Mm-hmm. And then we all ate there.
Meaning other companies, other units?
Yeah, it was a kind of an area kind of thing. All the company, all the units in that area ate at that mess hall.
Was it air conditioned?
Oh, no. There was no, I don't know of any air conditioning on Quan Loi at all. I don't know, maybe the brigade commander's trailer or something, but but no, nothing. I didn't see air conditioning except when I went on R&R.
Okay.
I said maybe once in a while when I went to the club in Benoit, mm-hmm. when we got back there once a month. You know, for mess hall food, it really wasn't bad. And the advantage of having the cook who was actually in my company, even though he didn't work for me, was if we were on alert or something, we were up in the middle of the night, he would make a tub of coffee or something like that. I mean, the old-fashioned way, you take a tub of boiling water and you pour coffee grounds in it, and then you put, I guess it's eggshells in it to set up the grounds out, and that was your coffee. Well, and he'd carry that out to the guys to help stay awake and that kind of stuff. It was noisy.
In what way?
It was always real noisy. There were always aircraft overhead, fixed wing and rotary wing. You know, as a brigade base camp, we had a lot of traffic in and out. So there were always C-130s going in and out, always CH-47s going in and out. And of course, hundreds of slips. It seemed like hundreds.
Right.
There was a 175 artillery battery across the street. That's a big gun, and it made a big bang. Mm-hmm. And so when they had fire mission, the whole area would shake. So it was always real noisy. Our company, there was kind of a perimeter within a perimeter. And there was some concertina right next to our company area. Vietnamese on the other side, and that's how we get our laundry done. We throw our stuff over to the concertina.
Really?
And they would do our laundry. They bring it back all wrapped in brown paper, and we'd hand them a few piastres, mm-hmm. and they'd throw our laundry back to us.
That's interesting. This was a little village, right?
A little village.
Okay.
And so that's how we got our laundry from our uniforms clean. We didn't just exchange uniforms in a mass like the guys in the field did. We had our uniforms, and that's what we wrote right. our names on the
right.
work. So, and I had my rank sewn on. The guys, the infantry guys, they'd get a shirt, and who knew who had it last, and they'd take a ballpoint pen and draw their rank on it. And put the X for the infantry cross rifles on it, but I never had to do that. And right down the center was the airstrip, and there were buildings all around it. The brigade talk, the tactical operations center. Mine was at kind of think of the south end of this long oval, mm-hmm. and with the airstrip up the middle of the oval. The brigade, if you're looking north, the brigade talk would be on the east side, kind of close to the inside of the perimeter, although they almost got blown up during a ground attack one night. We were having a big ground attack on both sides of the perimeter, both sides of this oval simultaneously, and one guy got through the wire and was running up the street toward the talk, the brigade talk, and of course they knew where everything was.
How did they know that?
Well, they had guys working on the base. You know, I mentioned the barber, mm-hmm. And these guys would wander around the base and draw maps and
pace off
things, and they probably had better grid coordinates on our brigade talk than we did. So he knew right where it was, and he had a big satchel charge. He was hooking up the street, and just as he got about halfway up the street, one of our guys came to the top of the stairs. I mean, the bunker, the perimeter was fully manned, but this guy had been down in the bunker, and he came to the top of the bunker and saw this guy running up the street. Well, fortunately, he had his M16 with him. Hadn't left it downstairs, and cut it down in the street. He'd come up 5 seconds later, that guy probably would have taken out the brigade talk. Oh, there was security around the top, too.
But, right.
So that was kind of a near thing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we had a little PX. It was, all things considered, pretty nicely stocked.
Could you buy in there?
Well, you're all your basic toiletries and that kind of thing. Letter writing supplies, film, basic cameras, that kind of stuff. And you could get a catalog where you could order just about anything. in good prices. I ordered a pretty nice stereo that I had shipped directly to Diane. And I ordered, bought a nice camera while I was there.
Did you take any pictures?
I took a whole lot of pictures, and I've got them at home. I'm meaning to dig them out and let you take a look at them, see what you want.
Once you document your experience, did you have a sense of trying to do that? Or did you just want to take pictures because you were in a foreign land or in a war?
A little of both. Uh-huh. A little of both. You know, I wanted to be able to show what it was like and look and see and remember what it was like. And it's, you know, it's funny how you remember some things. Yeah. One thing that I really remember I took pictures of was flying in a helicopter. You look down and you can see where there had been a B-52 strike.
Right.
In arc light. These huge holes in the ground. And no tree. They're just round. Just dirt. No trees, no shrubbery, no nothing living. And those things were just so enormously destructive.
Did you witness any of those?
From a distance.
What did it look like from a distance?
It just looked like about 3 square miles of Vietnam going up to dust and splinters. I mean, it would be, wish you could hear the sound, you couldn't hear the airplanes because they were too high.
Right.
And if you were, when we were in 1st and 5th, the cops would know when there was one going into their area. Mm-hmm. So you could kind of be watching for it. And it was just a very sudden thing. Just all of a sudden, this dust and smoke would just go right straight up in the air. Just in kind of like corn syrup, you know, mm-hmm. but just in sequence. Mm-hmm. And just an awesome looking things. And I never saw the aftermath, but guys said that there would be guys, you know, that if they hit a bunker complex or an enemy unit or something like that, there'd be guys that are dead, not a mark on them. This concussion. Wow. And other guys would just be shredded. Be parts of people in trees and what was left of trees. Mm-hmm. And just enormously destructive. Of course, that was the point.
Right.
Right. Kind of thing. So.
Unleashing maximum firepower.
Maximum violence.
In 1998, when I was traveling to Vietnam, the train between Hanoi and Hue. When dawn broke, I stood out and watched as we were passing the countryside and saw pock marks. And they were some of them kind of overgrown with some creepy weeds or something like that, but I could tell they were craters. Mm-hmm. Craters. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that after all this time it's still there.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you think that in Europe they're still finding bodies from World War II.
Yeah.
You know.
Live ordnance, and I mean, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
And it's, I mean, Europe's fairly densely populated.
Yes.
So it's not too surprising that it's still, the effects would still be there in Vietnam.
Let me ask you a question that might sound a bit odd, but when you were there, did you feel like you were in a war? Did you consciously go, wow, I'm in a war? Or this is serious? This is, how did that hit you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think we were all conscious of that. Very much so. For one thing, there were people you didn't even know shooting at you, you know, relatively frequently by ordinary standards. People you didn't even see. You know, I mean, you were just out there in the jungle somewhere lobbing mortar rounds or 122s at you. And then you had this sense of urgency. You really did have a sense of urgency about what you were doing. That you know, it was important and it needed to be done, and it needed to be done right and quickly. So yeah, I think that was something that was with us all the time.
Did you feel then that we were winning the war? The United States was winning the war? Did you have thoughts about that big picture and kind of why you were there and what were you succeeding along those lines?
I think that I can't say I ever felt we were really winning the war. I think the general feeling that the guys that I talked to about was we could win it.
Talk to them?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we could win it. We weren't.
So you were aware that the impression then was that the United States was not winning, not progressing?
Yeah, not progressing. And of course, by that time, that was a big focus of the media, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we knew all they had to do was scoot across the border into Cambodia and they were safe. You know, we knew the Chinese were helping. We knew the Russians were helping, which we kind of understood. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody was at war against the Soviets, we'd have helped them too. I mean, that was the game at that time.
So you guys did see it then in kind of the Cold War context?
Yeah, I think so. I can't say that we really, you know, analyzed it deeply or thought about it or talked about it for hours, but there was this sense of frustration that, you know, they were right there and there was nothing separating us but this imaginary, if you will, line on the border. You know, bear in mind, we were 25 years old, you know, political, the big geopolitical picture didn't mean a lot to us. And I won't say that the Cambodian border ever stopped us all the time either. It certainly didn't. But, you know, alerts from 1st to the 5th used to go over there reasonably routinely. This is no national secret, I think.
Mm-hmm, not at all.
I don't know that I ever went, but I was pretty close. From what we saw on the map, we were pretty darn close. You know, I'm talking about within yards.
Yeah. How frustrating was that for you?
Oh, very. Very. You know, we were all with Nixon, you know. You know, they're hiding in Cambodia. Cambodia's letting them do it. You know, they paid their nickel. They're going to take their chances. Mm-hmm. Let's go get them. And, you know, we didn't think much about the possibility of drawing China into the war as we had in Korea, or drawing the Soviet Union into the war more actively. Mm-hmm. And wasn't too worried about the Soviet Union, but the Chinese, I think, were a real possibility, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it was very frustrating.
You had a change of administration while during your tour there. What did you think about Richard Nixon, the incoming president, and kind of the direction where he was going to take the war in the country?
We thought he was going to be a little more aggressive about it. But we thought that I thought truly his mandate was to get us out. And he started talking about peace with honor, and I didn't see how we were going to do that at the time. I still don't see how we could have done that. I don't know of anybody that ever thought Vietnamization was going to work.
As far as your conversations?
As far as then and later. The heart, the fighting heart, I'm not saying they were bad, they were all bad soldiers. They weren't. Some of them were very good. South Vietnamese Marines were tough guys. But the fighting heart just wasn't there. And I just don't know of anybody that thought that was going to work.
Did the fact that negotiations were starting in earnest in Paris toward the end of your tour and then immediately when you came up, what do you think that did to morale? Did it have any effect upon you guys there? I mean, I don't know how aware you were of it then, but...
We had a television in the company area. We had kind of a little day room kind of thing. And we had a television, we got AFN, so we got the news and that kind of thing. So we kind of knew what was going on. I watched the first landing on the moon.
Did you?
Yeah, standing in my company day room. So we weren't completely isolated.
How did you feel when you saw that? Were you proud?
Oh, I was very proud. I thought, man, this is amazing. How in the world did they ever do that? I mean, I am just awed by that. I mean, that is such a huge accomplishment. Mm-hmm. You know, when Bush said we're going to go to Mars, I just thought, man, that's great, let's go. Mm-hmm. You know, can I go? Yeah. he'd probably think I was a little long in the tooth for that. But I just thought that was amazing. I've always been a science fiction fan. And I just think that's something mankind needs to do and should do. So. Yeah, I just thought my jaw just hit the floor.
And here you are standing in Vietnam, 10,000 miles away from home, in the middle of a war. And
yeah.
You've got an American up there on the surface of the moon. I know that had to be a weird feeling.
It was very weird, and I never looked at the full moon in the same sense. It was just an amazing feeling. And, you know, I had the feeling that, as I do now in the war on terror, that the United States can do anything that it gets really serious about, that it really puts its mind to. And that's one thing that was pretty frustrating about Vietnam.
So does that follow for Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. We could have. You know. But obviously, the collective America collectively, we didn't put our mind to it. I'm not worried about the war on terror. We're going to win. It may take a while, but we're going to win. You know, anything that this country puts its mind to, like we did going to the moon, we can do. And I don't think that's bravado, and I don't think it's bragging. I think we have shown that as a nation.
I interrupted you with the story of television. You were able to see maybe the news go on?
Yeah, so we could see. You know, as I said, as 24, 25-year-olds, we were just terribly frustrated and cynical about the lack of progress in the talks. You know, at that time, why in the hell are we spending 6 weeks talking about the shape of the table? Well, I'm a little older now, hopefully a little wiser. I think I understand it a little better now. It was the same thing at the end of the Korean War. You know, what shape is the table going to be? How long is the table? Who's going to sit where? It's just that jockeying for a position kind of thing. But, of course, we didn't understand that at the time. We thought, who the hell cares? Sit down and talk about ending the war.
You know? Did you all want the war to end?
Oh, yeah, we wanted to go home.
What about the overall war effort? Did you say, hey, we want to go home and let's end this thing? Or did you say, let me just get out of here?
And let me just go home. You know, I want to go home. By that time, you know, I hit one of the mistakes I made was that I took my R&R way too early.
And, I want you to tell me about your R&R, but tell me about that. Why did you take it so early?
Because I wanted to go see my wife and my baby. I'd never seen my baby, you know. And I figured, okay, I'll split the tour more or less in half. Mm-hmm. That's a good way to do it. It turned out to be a terrible way to do it because after that time, it really dragged. I mean, the first half of that tour went by like that.
Because you're looking forward to it.
Just a blink of an eye. And after that, I mean, it dragged. It really dragged. And even though I was doing something I enjoyed, I liked what I was doing, it was exciting, it was interesting. Don't get me wrong, but you know, I wanted to go home and see my wife and see my baby. And I mean, it just ran by after that R&R.
Like you were counting days.
Oh, I definitely was counting days.
You had your calendar?
Oh, I did. Everybody did, yeah.
What did your calendar look like?
Oh, gosh. It was, I think, an eagle. Okay. That had 365 little blocks in it. And I did it right down to the end.
Faithfully. You know, did you faithfully. Every morning when you would wake up, just color in?
Yeah, every day.
Every
morning.
Okay. We'll save R&R for our next session. But okay. Tell me about writing home when you're Quamalu. You wrote Diana?
Virtually every day.
And did she write you in return?
Virtually every day. I can't think of a day that Diana missed writing. If I was, you know, in the middle of something, moving or something like that, I might not write, but I think she wrote every single day. Sent me pictures. And
what did that do for you?
I just couldn't wait for a mail call. I mean, you know, company clerk could bring me my mail right away. Denny Honaker. Denny was my company clerk. He was not a company clerk, he was a mechanic, but he was had a little bit of education and a smart guy, so and screwed up and said he could type, so he became the company clerk. Just getting those letters and everybody, you just stopped what you were doing. Now, didn't matter what you were doing, you stopped. And you sat down and you read your mail right then.
Did mail come at a certain time every day?
You know, within an hour or two. Some, you know, obviously on some days the convoy got slowed down, it'd be later or might be a little earlier if they moved fast. But
when was that time? Was it noontime?
Gosh. I want to say around 3 PM, something like that. And I just couldn't wait to feel them first to see if there's pictures in there, you know, and that kind of stuff. And then you got to sort them. Because you might go 2 weeks and not get a letter.
How did you sort them? Did you do it by
date?
Once you opened it up, by date or by postmark?
By postmark. Yeah. Diana mailed them every day, but they sit in an APO somewhere.
Right.
And stack up, so you sort them into order by postmark and you open one at a time, you know. So that, you know, you kind of live it, mm-hmm. live through it with Diana. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way I did it. I guess different guys have different ways, but I always sorted mine. So.
Did you tell her about everything that was happening, or did you try to sit, not talk about the unpleasantries or what?
No, I tried to spare her a little bit. She was worried enough. She didn't need to know that we got a big brown attack last night. And, you know, there were bad guys in the wire and one almost 50 feet from my company perimeter and stuff like that.
Right.
But she didn't need to know about that. It's, you know, she had enough going on. Being scared that I was over there anyway. Not worried about, and of course, what the media covered was the guys in the field, and that was appropriate. They were the guys that needed to get covered. But all you heard about was the dead and the wounded. You know, the guys in my line of work, we didn't have a real high casualty rate. I mean, that's just the way it was. You know, I mean, I was inside a couple perimeters inside a brigade fire base. You know, with a couple of infantry companies providing security. No, that's, it wasn't a high mortality job, but Diana didn't know that. And so she was worried enough.
Right.
I didn't see any reason to add to that.
Does she know where you were located upon the way to Diana?
You know, it's funny. Yeah, we talked about that last night when we were talking about her coming in for an interview.
Uh-huh.
And she said, well, you know, by the time I got your letters, you were never where you said you were in the letters. You always moved on.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, there was no censorship. I could always tell her.
Right.
Where we were, and I tell her, you know, X miles north of Saigon or whatever it happened to be, and she would do the same thing. She'd go a week without a letter, and then she would send them
right
all at once.
Right. Okay. Let's end on this. I only ask you, what was it like for you to be at war and have a baby at home? And obviously, it's difficult. Tell me about that process. How did you deal with that day to day? Just knowing that your little girl is slowly growing there without you. Obviously, well taken care of and loved.
Oh, yeah,
no question. Question there. But just that separation as a father, what was that like?
Well, that was really difficult. I had pictures of Diana and the baby. I mean, just all over the place.
What's her name? Did you
mind? Lynn.
Lynn.
Okay. Lynn. Yeah. And Lynn was 4 months old when I saw her in R&R. And then she was 10 months old when I got home. And of course, she had no clue who I was when I got home. Well, either time.
Right. I'm sure you informed her of that.
Oh, yes.
I am your father.
Well, when I got home and I surprised Diana, I got a drop, which means I came home 2 days earlier than I would have been scheduled. And so I surprised Diana. And after I hooked her and everything, Lynn was sitting on the living room floor, you know, 10 months old, and I went over and scooped her up and hugged her. She just screamed bloody murder. Scared the poor kid half to death. And I haven't let her forget it to this day. But,
is she now an only child?
Oh, no. We have two girls.
Right, okay.
Lynn and Kathy.
Okay, is that L-Y-N-N?
Yes.
And C-A or K?
C-A-T-H-Y.
Okay. Have you told Lynn about kind of that first year of her life, or the first 10 months?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I saw you one time, and here's mm-hmm. what she looked like in Hawaii.
Yeah, we've talked about it, and she knows, I scared her half to death the first time, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was difficult being away. In fact, when Lynn was born, I was on a fire base with 1st of the 5th Cav, and the Red Cross would call and tell you, and so we got the message and everything. And the PX bird had just been out. The PX system used to fly a helicopter out to battalion fire bases with some basic stocks from the PX, you know, basic toiletries, cigarettes, that kind of stuff. And I had bought a box of cigars, so I passed around the cigars and that kind of stuff. And one of my jobs at that time was to report at the evening briefing for the battalion commander and the foxhole strength of each company. How many men not were in the company, but were actually out in the jungle fighting? Mm-hmm. And one of the other guys, one of the other lieutenants, stood up and announced that the foxhole strength of the Curry family had increased by one that day. So that's how Lynn's announcement was brought into Vietnam. Let's see. Yeah, I thought so. But anyway, yeah, it was pretty difficult. And you just coped, you know. We had pictures all over the place. And company commander, I kind of had my own little room with the Supreme Luxury had a door to my room. You couldn't ever close it because it was too hot, but I had one.
A door to your office during the day or a door to where you
belonged? Both. And I mentioned that we had a kind of little company administrative building. It was a Quonset hut. Is what it was. The front half was company offices. Company commander, first sergeant, company clerk had an open area out there. The back half was the officers' quarters. And we had two or three officers at any given time. And the other officers had kind of an open bay kind of area. And the company commander had a little, it was more like a glorified closet, but had a little private area with a couple wall lockers and that kind of stuff. And I had pictures in there, and I had pictures in my office. And I what you think everybody did, but
right. Would you all spend time talking about your families?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. All the time.
Well, why don't we end on that note today, and we'll continue for our next session.
This is Dr. Richard Ferrone. I am continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Pat Curry. Pat and I are again in Lubbock in the interview room on campus of Texas Tech University. Today is July 29th, 2005, and it's about 9:20 a.m. Central Standard Time. Pat, why don't we pick up with a couple of things. First, though, you said that you did have some thoughts and you wanted to make a comment about the enemy and their leadership. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, I said before a couple of times that I had a lot of respect for the soldiers, that they were tough soldiers, that they were good soldiers. They had a cause they really believed in. But I have absolutely no use for, respect for, nothing but loathing for the leadership, mostly because of the way they treated the prisoners. It was torture for torture's sake. There was no rationale for it, no justification for it. Mm-hmm. A civilized society like they purport to have does not treat human beings that way. And it was disgusting, and still is. And they should pay the price for that, for the way they treated those people.
Were you all aware of that POWs were there and some of the stories coming out while you were in country, or is this what you heard like when they came home?
Oh, no, we had heard heard the stories and heard of the torture and that kind of thing. And of course then we had our buddy Jane Fonda's word that they were all being treated humanely and three squares a day and all that good stuff, which of course was total BS. Mm-hmm. And we tended to get a lot of that from her. But we were pretty much aware of it.
Tell me about Jane Fonda and the anti-war movement that a lot of veterans consider, and I'm not including you in on this until you say you're in or not in, but a lot of veterans look at the anti-war movement protesters who focused on the quote-unquote sympathy for the enemy, who didn't see North Vietnam as, say, the Pentagon or the White House did, or maybe some of the veterans, a lot of the veterans in country did. What can you say about that portion of the anti-war movement? And Jane was out there in front, literally in Hanoi.
Well, I can explain my position to you this way, that when the guy spit tobacco juice on her at the bookstore, I called and contributed to his bail. Certainly would contribute to his defense should anything be necessary, and would be more than willing to go up there and stand there and cheer.
That was just recently.
Just recently,
a few months ago.
Yeah, when she put her book out. Mm-hmm. And there was, of course, she started up again on the Iraq War. And there was a quote from a veteran in there that people who were not there have no idea of the loathing that we have for that woman. That's from the paper, and it exactly echoes my sentiments.
Is that, well, why is that so strong still today, continuing?
She committed treason, not once, but many times. She stood there on a North Vietnamese artillery piece, anti-aircraft piece, while our guys were dying in South Vietnam. And she encouraged the enemy. She clearly was on their side. She clearly lied about how the POWs were being treated. Part of the problem is that she is dumb as a bag of hammers. Two more points on her IQ, she'd be a brick. But that does not in any way excuse what she did while our guys were dying over there. She was giving, as the saying goes, aid and comfort to the enemy. And I just wish I'd thought of spitting tobacco juice on her. Mm-hmm.
Passions obviously run deep when it comes to that type of protesting against the war. Can you make some comments on the anti-war movement in general? And feel free to talk about when you were home and what you saw. Once you, I mean, you remained in the military, you came back, and you went on with your life. Tell me about your thoughts on the anti-war movement. And also, is it possible for the anti-war movement to do it appropriately?
It certainly is possible for them to do it appropriately. And one of the reasons that we have a military and that we have soldiers is so that is to protect people's right to protest and to voice their opinions. I mean, that's, you know, we defend the Constitution of the United States. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. That's our job. Our profession, mm-hmm. and they certainly have the right to do that. And if they're speaking out of conscience, then they have every right and probably to some degree an obligation to speak out. My problem was, and I had a couple of problems with the anti-war movement. One was some of the methods that they chose. The idea of blowing up laboratories, college labs, and killing people as a protest against violence just somehow doesn't ring true with me. Doesn't seem to be a very consistent position with me. The violent protests, I think, were way out of hand. The other problem I had with it was that I felt there were a lot of people of conscience who just felt strongly about the war. And I disagree with them, but I respect their position. There were a lot of people who were in it because it was trendy, because it was the thing to do. Because that's what their friends were doing, and they just wanted to be in with the group. Mm-hmm. And I have no respect for them at all. They had no clue what they were talking about, no idea. They had not done any thinking about it. They had not done any real research or study or anything else. They were just out there because it was the thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember Nixon's comment in his discussions and announcements to the United States about the silent majority? The silent majority is out there. The minority are the ones who are vocal and protesting. Did you believe that at the time?
Yeah, I sure did. And to some extent, I still do. Mm-hmm. And I think that that a lot of people who supported the war, or at least who were not violently opposed to it, strongly opposed to it, just kind of didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that was a very real phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I think it's a real shame what Nixon did to the country.
As far as Watergate is concerned?
As far as Watergate and all of that, over what was, in essence, a very minor break-in. I mean, there was no reason for it is the thing. But anyway, and of course, what was going on with Nixon, I think, added fuel to the anti-war fire.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, when I came back, my wife was living in with her parents in the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to with her sister and brother-in-law to see Hair, which was a big musical
yes.
at that time. Well, one of the things they do is
and it's back and popular now.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things in there was they start playing with the flag. And I got up and walked out. And, of course, Diana was scared to death. I was going to start throwing hand grenades or something. But but I was really upset and all that, and I wasn't. You know, like I told her, I had just come back from 12 months of trying to make sure that the right to do that continues.
Mm-hmm.
I just disagreed with it, mm-hmm. And I didn't want to watch it. I was a little disappointed. I was the only one in the theater that got up and walked out. But no, I wasn't thrilled about it, but I wasn't angry about it. I just didn't want to watch it. And that, to me, that's a parallel with the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
But, and they have a right to do that. They do not have a right to become violent, to kill people, to blow up property, and that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about that when you get back home and your experiences and what you saw. I wanted to go back to Vietnam for a little while and ask you, if you could, tell me about your R&R and what that experience was like. Most of the married men went to Hawaii to see the wives. Tell me about that and your emotions, your feelings about seeing Diana and that, but also having to leave her and go back to the war and knowing you had some time left over there.
R&R, of course, needless to say, was great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we hit Hawaii the same time as 14,000 international Rotarians. It was the International Rotary Convention that year in Hawaii, so it was just us and 14,000 of our closest friends.
Mm-hmm.
I had sent off for hotel reservations, but they had not gotten back to me in time.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a pretty good system. The military had a pretty good system set up. And despite the crunch, they found a nice room for us. And it was actually a little apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this just as clear as if it was last week. And, of course, Diana had brought the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was that like for you?
Oh, it was amazing.
I mean, you're coming out of a war for a little while. You're seeing your wife for the first time in quite a while, and you're a new dad.
It was amazing. I mean, you just look at that. You know, it's the typical dad thing,
mm-hmm.
Except it's a delayed reaction. You look at that little baby, and you think, you know, good grief, I had a hand in creating that little baby, and it's just it was really great.
Mm-hmm.
And Diana used to tell me if I didn't put her down, I was going to rub shiny spots on her.
So you just couldn't get enough of her?
Just couldn't get enough of her. And we had a great time. I was late picking Diana up at the airport. I got lost on the way to the airport. But she was still there getting ready to get on the bus to the R&R Center, so I caught her. And she had worn my favorite dress. And she remembered and wore that and had the baby and all. And so we... of course, had a long hello, but we spent the next week just, I don't think we were ever apart more than 10 seconds, us and the baby. It was mm-hmm. it was generally all three of us. We did find a babysitter one night, and the two of us went out
mm-hmm.
by ourselves. And I mean, we did the whole touristy thing. We wore matching Hawaiian shirts and the whole works, and, We had a rental car. We toured around the island and walked on Waikiki. When I got back, I got my hotel reservations at the Ilokai, which was a very nice hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little late then.
Mm-hmm.
I could not get enough of baked potatoes with sour cream and fresh salad.
You ate a bunch.
Oh, I ate a bunch, yeah. And drank some wine and all that good stuff. And it was extremely difficult going back. It was very, very difficult going back. And We actually we had bought Diane and the baby so much stuff we had to buy another suitcase. It was tough going back. I tell you, that airplane going back to Vietnam from Hawaii was awful quiet. Full of guys who were still back in Hawaii, mainly with their families, and it was real quiet on that airplane.
How long did you have back in Vietnam?
I had about 5 months left.
What did you all say to each other? I mean, did you tell her, yeah, we're getting mortared every two or three nights, and you know, this is the
size. No, I tried not to dwell on those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned before. I figured she was scared enough. I didn't need to add to that. She knew we were getting shot at, and I didn't hide it. Mm-hmm. I told her, yeah, we get shot at every now and then, but there was no sense in, you know, trying to make her think that, you know, we were going through World War III. For one thing, we weren't.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that you know, that was a lot of fun, but there was just no sense in piling on her more than we needed to. When I got back, I told her a little more than I had than I did while I was there.
Yeah. What do you think you all talked about the most about the war? Or did you try not to talk about the war?
Really didn't talk about it very much. Really talked about us and the baby and what our plans were for what's going to happen when I got back. You know, was I going to stay in the Army? And at that point, I knew I was going to stay in at least another year. But what was going to happen past that? We both knew I needed to go back to school. We didn't know the Army was going to send me back at that point, so we talked about that. But there were just long silences where we just sat there together. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about the war that much.
When you left, did you say, I'll definitely be seeing you back, or did you? What? How do you do that? How do you leave your wife and back into a war?
Well, you know, you don't have much choice. You just do what you got to do. And I just said, well, I'll see you in 5 months, or you know, I'm scheduled to come home on this day, and look for me that day. And we actually had made that early, even made some plans. And she was going to come up to San Francisco, and we came into Travis and. Just outside of San Francisco, she was going to come up and meet me. Mm-hmm. And we were going to rent a car and drive down the coast, just mm-hmm. back together. Didn't work out that way mm-hmm. Because I came home a few days early. But we had actually even made some plans. So we kind of had that to look forward to, and we kind of had, we were kind of looking more forward past Vietnam, mm-hmm. I think. Is probably the way we really kind of got through it, mm-hmm. is we were really looking in November when I got home and we were together again. I think is probably the way we got through it best.
Yeah, that makes sense from a human standpoint to focus on what your future is going to be. Did you feel and think at this time, this is going to be my career?
No.
Weren't thinking that yet?
No, not at all.
Okay. Did you realize that having a command in Vietnam during a war was really going to propel you forward? That was going to be a very good thing for your career?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think every officer knew command. Number one, command is good.
Yes.
And command in Vietnam is better. And command in Vietnam as a first lieutenant is just an extraordinary opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I kind of figured if I did well, it certainly would help me out. Okay. And I subsequently was proved right. And
yes. Did you tell her about Colonel Hawk?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, told her a lot about him. I had written to her in letters and all that about Colonel Hawk. So the name was somewhat familiar to her. And, you know, he was a big part of my life over there, obviously, as a battalion commander. When you're a company commander, the battalion commander is kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, God. Mm-hmm. And and she knew that I was actually enjoying what I was doing, which I was. Mm-hmm. And I mean, command is there's just nothing like it in the world. It's just the best thing
the best job in the world, bar none. And I was just so much more fortunate than a lot of my colleagues who, if you ever wanted to make major, you had to be a company commander, but they kind of, some of them kind of went out and did their command and then went back to a staff job or a depot job or something like that. Didn't really get to work with troops a lot, and so I was pretty fortunate that I spent a lot of time with troops as a lieutenant, and as a captain, and a major, and a lieutenant colonel, and so I was pretty fortunate in my career path.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all luck either. I pretty actively worked for it, I didn't have all troop assignments. I don't think anybody does, but I certainly tried to do that whenever I could.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say command is the best job anyone could have?
Well, for one thing, it's just a tremendous level of responsibility. You know, the cliche is that you're responsible for everything unit does or fails to do, but you're really kind of the master of your own fate.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really decide whether you're going to be successful or not to a very large extent. Obviously, a lot of it depends on your boss, but you know, it's a lot of responsibility and it's a lot of authority. You're getting to work directly with soldiers, and that's the best part of it.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, and I'm sure it's the same now, but at that time, it was a real interesting mix because of the draft. And I think I mentioned we had everything from guys who had been homeless to guys with master's degrees.
Yes.
And so that made kind of an interesting mix.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very solid professional NCO corps at that time. And so it was just an amazing job. It's hard to describe.
Obviously, your personality fits that of a leader because you liked the responsibility.
Yeah.
You say that now, upon a few months out from your retirement from Texas Tech University. When you were back then, 26, 27 there in country?
Uh-huh.
Did you realize that then, this does fit me. This leadership does fit me. I'm okay with this, and I can actually use this to propel me forward, either in the military if I choose that, but also in life. Were you feeling that then?
No, I really wasn't. It just kind of seemed natural. I had a superb role model.
Yes.
You know, I could watch Colonel Honk and how he acted towards his staff and towards me, get a lot of good ideas from that. But it just kind of seemed to fit. It just kind of seemed to come naturally, and I believe then, and I believe now, if you treat people right, let them know what the standards are, and expect them to meet those standards, and then get out of the way that 95 people out of 100 are going to meet those standards, or at least bust their butts trying to meet those standards. And that was certainly true in B Company.
Okay.
And I mentioned all the Article 15s mm-hmm. and all of that when I was first took over, and that was part of setting those standards and letting them know what the standards were and that they had to be met.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys are not dumb. They caught on real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I had more than one tell me they appreciated it. And not all of them. You know,
sure.
When I took the stripe off a guy, he very rarely appreciated it. But I never had anybody tell me, superior or subordinate or peer, tell me that, you shouldn't have given that Article 15, that wasn't right, or something like that. So,
okay.
And it just kind of, I enjoyed it, and I think that showed.
Mm-hmm.
I was good at getting along with the customers. Not because I was smart, I guess I was a good salesman or something, but I would go out and visit and see if they needed something, if there was something that I could get for them, and they said, yeah, I really need one of these, and I'd really try to get it for them. And I think they appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you did travel and go out and see your customers, as you say, did Do you have anything ever happen, anything interesting, experiences, incidents that come to mind? You know, when you talk about that today, what do you see?
No, not really. One interesting kind of thing that happened was we had an infantry unit that had been one of our customers while they were in the rear. In logistics, that's how we refer to them.
Yes,
is customers.
Was that an Army instruction or
no? That was just the way it was.
Okay.
You know, that was the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a captain tell me, he said, "You got to take care of your customers. That's the best way to succeed." And he was right too. And that was just the culture. That's what we called them, and we really took it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
We had an infantry unit who had been a customer. They had moved out, and I had gone over to their old area that they had vacated. And for some reason, there was an old wall locker in there, and for some reason I opened that up, and more out of idle curiosity, I guess, than anything. There was a 50 caliber machine gun in there. And I thought, okay. And apparently somebody had stuck it in this locker and forgot it.
Mm-hmm.
And property accountability was not one of our strong points in Vietnam. So anyway, I picked it up, threw it in my Jeep, took it back. Well, it was unserviceable, and we couldn't repair it.
Mm-hmm.
We had what's called loose rivets, which means that it has to go back to the depot to be repaired. We couldn't do it. But I knew one of the infantry units could use this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I took this 50 caliber receiver and a case of beer and walked across the street to the 11th ACR and swapped it for a good 50 caliber receiver. And as long as 11th ACR, of course, they had a bunch of tracks, so they had more 50 calibers than they knew what to do with. But our guys were always scrounging for them for base defense. And so anyway, I swapped them.
Mm-hmm.
They had the unserviceable one they could turn in to account for it.
Right.
I had a nice serviceable one and gave it to one of the infantry battalions, and they took it out and set it up on their fire base for base defense.
Hmm.
And made a friend there.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Didn't make much of a friend to the accountability system, but sure made a friend to that battalion. So.
Well, that was purely on your own. You had that kind of, authority, or you can move around freely like that and not, I don't mean this in a bad way, but take advantage of the system.
Absolutely.
And of course, in the best interest of the effort, the war effort, as
sure.
You saw.
Sure. And I felt it was, but, it was a different culture in terms of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot more permissive, way too permissive in many instances. But, when you're in a war zone, things that are important in a peacetime army, important in the States, are not important. And so there was a lot of stuff that we just didn't mess with and didn't bother with.
Mm-hmm. You said that you would go into Benoit once a month.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me, describe Benoit, what it looked like to you? I mean, this is right outside Saigon. This is one of the major areas that the United States has all kinds of troops coming in and out of there. Major air base. What was it like there?
I thought it was huge. It was just huge. And the difference, I think, was that it had relatively permanent buildings, had paved roads,
mm-hmm.
Had hot showers and flush toilets and all those things I didn't get to see the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at that age, didn't bother you.
Right.
Not to see those kinds of things. I just never really thought about it very much.
Mm-hmm.
I would go down to the airfield. Well, it divided into before and after. The battalion commander eventually got his own helicopter. And he would send that out to pick up the company commanders to bring them back for the monthly meeting, which was kind of nice. And
would you stay overnight?
Yes, usually for a couple of nights. You just turn the company over to the XO. You're in radio contact, but
mm-hmm.
turn the company over to the XO and come on down. But before the helicopter, you go down the airfield and scrounge a ride down to Benoit. And there was enough air traffic where it never took you very long. Go down to Benoit and Somebody would meet you at the airfield with a vehicle and take you back to battalion headquarters. And, you know, as officers, we had kind of our own little cubicle in a hooch somewhere, not air conditioned. But we would have staff meetings during the day and take lots of hot showers and in the evenings and get some nice clean clothes. And like I say, the big difference, I think, was the semi-permanent buildings and the paved roads. Had a very nice club. Air conditioned. You could go in there and get a nice steak dinner, which I did. Enjoyed that. And it was kind of a nice time to let the pressure kind of bleed off. And
Could you ever take anybody with you, your XO with you, or your NCOs, or nobody would go with you?
No, it was just the commander.
Okay. What kind of entertainment do they have down there at the officers' club?
Well,
and of course, you don't have to comment on any of this, but it just
no, it's fine. They would have USO shows that came through periodically, usually with women dancers and a rock and roll band of some kind. We had one in our battalion area in Tania, came through and set up in one of the buildings, and everybody just dragged in a folding chair and a cold beer, and we sat there and watched the USO show.
What was the show? Was it like a Filipino band? Or?
Yeah, this particular one was, but they would also have them from the U.S.
How were they? Were the Filipino bands good?
A lot of enthusiasm.
Oh, yeah? they had it, or you guys?
They had it. We had a lot of enthusiasm for the women, but they had a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy, I'll put it that way. And, of course, they varied from really horrible to fair. But they were there with us, you know, and they were out in the relatively forward area getting shot at. Not like the donut dollies who would get on a helicopter and go out to the battalion fire base. But I never understood how those ladies did it. So, they would often have some fairly good groups there. Bob Hope came to Benoit, and I did not get to see him. I did get to meet him 25 years later when he came to Berlin. When the wall came down, he came, and I got to meet him, shake his hand, and went to his show. Of course, Raquel Welch came through Benoit and all of that good stuff. I didn't get to see any of that, but...
Could you have if you wanted to?
No way. There were 500,000 guys that wanted to get into that show, and it was pretty... Like, our infantry battalion would get one allocation to send a guy.
Oh, wow.
And
it wasn't going to be Lieutenant Curry.
No, it wasn't going to be Lieutenant Curry, that's for sure. Actually, some other lieutenant went. Lieutenant from the S3.
How did that happen? Did someone just choose? He got lucky. Someone liked him.
Exactly. I always thought we should have picked a grunt out of the field, but that was personal opinion. Which with Second Lieutenant Curry didn't carry a hell of a lot of weight. But anyway, they would have shows there, and then off post. I call it off post, not in the main club or something like that. They would have different kinds of shows and other forms of entertainment. That the guys would go to one of the special forces groups there at a club that was pretty wild, and we used to drink a lot. A lot. God, I could never survive that today. But all the guys who were from the more forward areas would we tended to overdo it, to put it very mildly.
Did the USO shows work in the sense that did it boost morale, kind of make things a bit? Or that day, or life in general, a little bit better for a while.
Yeah, for an hour or two, it was something different, and it was an AFN, it was something a little bit different.
Tell me about the donut dollies. We've had some donut dollies involved in the program here, and I've had commentary on them before from individuals. What was your experience with them?
My experience with them was good. They were nice ladies. Some very young ladies, some of them quite attractive, and then And of course, you get guys who hadn't seen a Caucasian woman in 8-10 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you put these ladies out there, and these guys were less than restrained. They handled it with such grace that I was just always impressed. I mean, I was embarrassed for them.
Mm-hmm.
They played these kind of silly little games, and the games weren't the point. Everybody knew that. The point was they got to talk to a woman and see somebody who didn't smell like bug juice.
Mm-hmm.
But they always, in my experience anyway, handled it with such grace. And a lot of guys used to make fun of them and kind of give them a hard time, and I never really kind of understood that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did that because they wanted to do that and they wanted to contribute. And
they were Red Cross volunteers.
Yeah, yeah, and I had a lot of respect for them. And they didn't have to get on that helicopter and take a chance of getting shot down. They could have been back in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of respect for them, and I thought they did some good things. I'm not sure it was a good idea to remind guys of what they were missing, but the ladies themselves were interesting and fun, I thought.
When you said that sometimes guys would make fun of them, what did they do? Do you remember?
What did the guys do?
Yeah, to make fun of them.
Oh, just donut dollies, you know, give me a donut, you live in the rear and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you're not really out here with the grunts and that kind of thing, but, you know, that's just pointless, just BS.
Yeah. Okay. Pat, what about... just incidents in general that maybe we have not touched upon from your time, both Tainan and Quan Loy in general. What do you want to leave on the record as some things that happened to you? And of course, we can always come back and talk about things, but are there significant happenings that we have not talked about that you would like to talk about?
Oh, just some kind of miscellaneous things. I think... one of my favorite all-time second lieutenant stories, battalion rear was, when I was in 1st or the 5th, the battalion rear was in Tainan, and of course Ford was out on the fire base,
mm-hmm.
and we had an infantry second lieutenant on the fire base, and he was one of these guys who was, I'm not going to ask my men to do anything that I'm not going to do myself,
mm-hmm.
which is a good thing up to a point. But of course, they used to have to rotate what we called, pardon the expression, but shit burning detail.
Mm-hmm.
And, the outhouses were just a 55-gallon drum.
Yes.
And, of course, on the fire base, they were real temporary. Usually what you do is take a sandbag crate, which was maybe 4x4x8,
mm-hmm.
stand it up on its end,
mm-hmm.
slide a board in there with a hole on it, and then a 55-gallon drum in back. Did that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You have to slide that drum out once a day, put some diesel in it, and burn it.
Right.
And that's one of my most distinctive memories, is that smell.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it wasn't,
mm-hmm.
but it is. But anyway.
Have you ever smelled it since Vietnam?
Never. Not ever since. And hope I never do again.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so there we were out on a fire base, and this lieutenant was going to show his men that he was going to do anything they would do, so he was going to take his turn at shit burning duty. And he did. He pulled the drum out, put some diesel in it, stirred it up, and threw it a match, and it started burning. Unfortunately, he'd only pulled it out halfway. So the battalion commander comes out of the talk, roll of toilet paper in hand, just in time to see his outhouse going up in flames.
The battalion commander was
there.
He was going over
the talk. He was on his way to it.
Okay.
And of course, the troops, if we had had an attack then, we'd have been done for, because everybody was laughing so hard we couldn't even stand up, let alone. I mean, guys came from all over the fire base to see that.
What did the battalion commander do?
He just shook his head, turned around, and walked back in.
Did that
that lieutenant, I guess.
There wasn't anything he could do at that point. He just kind of stood there and watched, and mm-hmm. he never took that particular duty again. Yeah. I'm not sure anybody would have let him.
Right.
So,
what else?
But that's one of my favorite second lieutenant stories.
Mm-hmm.
Bear in mind, I was second lieutenant
right,
at the time.
Right.
I had one casualty in my company when I was a company commander.
Mm-hmm.
We had been getting a big series of ground attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, like every other unit, tenant unit, we called them on the installation, we had to provide guys for perimeter duty. And
was this at Tainan? Or
this was at Quan Loi. This was after when I was the B Company commander. And this guy, we got a big ground attack, and he actually got a very, very slight head wound, a piece of shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I went to see him, and he was one of my real problems.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was. I had a couple, two or three guys that were problems, but he was one of them. And
what was his problem?
Yeah, well, number one, he didn't want to do anything. So the other guys were going to have to kind of carry his load.
Mm-hmm.
Lazy as hell. He was a discipline problem. I suspected he was using drugs, etc. But anyway, and I knew I was going to have to do something. I just wasn't sure what yet, and I wasn't sure what he was going to do that was going to require me to take some kind of action. But anyway, head wounds were automatically medevaced. And I went down and see him, and he had kind of this cut on his forehead. I took his stuff down to him, and so they medevaced him out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just kind of a win-win for everybody. He got out, and I got rid of him. So
he stayed out?
He stayed gone, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm sure he didn't get much farther back than the field hospital,
mm-hmm.
but because he just wasn't hurt that bad.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, head wounds were automatically medevaced. So,
okay.
And that was the only casualty. And then we walked along the perimeter, and there were bodies everywhere.
American or?
Oh no, DC? No. God, the American bodies didn't lay there 90 seconds. That just didn't happen. Just did not happen. It took a little longer to police up the DC. And,
did you have that duty? Did you have to go out and do
no,
that?
No. Uh-uh. The infantry guys did all that. And the infantry units who were commanding that segment of the perimeter,
mm-hmm.
and the guys who were assigned to them.
Sure.
They almost didn't look human. Some of them were so torn up. You know, when you get hit by direct fire from 105 or from a recoilless rifle, it doesn't leave a very pretty sight. And you just don't even think about them as people. I think you can't. You know, but it was pretty rough to see that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the closest I came to getting killed was by our own guys. When you fire a four-deuce flare, some stuff comes out the back. Well, you're supposed to fire it so that stuff comes out the back outside the perimeter. And our guys weren't doing that. And I'm standing in the company area, and all of a sudden, with a couple of guys, and we were getting a heavy ground attack off to one side.
Mm-hmm.
And so we heard this whistling sound. And, of course, first thing you think is incoming. So you kind of get down, and about 5 feet away from me, I heard this chunk, and it turned out to be a plug from a four-deuce flare, which is about a 5-pound piece of steel.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at that time, it's traveling at terminal velocity. If it hit anybody, it had gone right straight through them. And unfortunately, it missed us, but some of the other stuff that came out hit the company dog. And we had to take her down and put her down, hit her on the head. And I won't go into details, but she clearly was suffering, and there wasn't much call for vet service. So we had to take her out, put her down. And, you know, it's interesting that we were going through all this, and
one of the guys that kind of adopted her and was taking care of her, one of my guys, took her down and put her down and came back, and he was crying. Mm-hmm. You know, he was really, I mean, genuinely upset. And he'd gotten real close to to this just old stray dog, you know. So it was pretty tough on him. And several of the guys, but he was the one I remember crying, feeling bad, and I felt bad for him. And
did you all have pets besides this dog?
Well, just stray dogs. Well, wandering through.
Do you remember the name of this dog?
No, I sure don't.
Okay.
Not after all this time.
Okay.
But and there were lots of stray dogs wandering around, kind of thing. But,
okay.
Anyway, by the time Colonel Hawk got up, after this big crowd attack, all the bodies had been policed up and everything. Still lots of craters and that kind of thing, but the interesting part is we had just gotten new, got a new brigade commander about a month before. One of his major priorities was upgrading the green line, the perimeter. And fortunately, what the green line was in essence two rows of concertina wire, razor wire, separated by a space.
How tall would the concertina wire?
9 feet.
Be on the ground? It was 9 feet tall.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was designed to be so thick that you couldn't get through it. Well, of course, you can always get through it. But the point was to slow them down enough that they became a target.
How'd they get through it? Cutting it?
And cutting it, yeah.
Going very slowly?
Man, they put on a demonstration. They had a sapper who was a POW. And they put on a demonstration where this guy went through concertina. It was amazing. I mean, he went through that stuff like it wasn't even there.
Wow.
He just, I mean, it was so thick, but he just kind of wiggled and wove his way through it,
and
totally silently. And in a couple of seconds, he was through this 6 foot wide, 9 foot high, triple strand concertina barrier. It was incredible. We were all standing there with our mouths open. It scared the hell out of us, to tell you the truth. But the brigade commander's priority was to upgrade this. Unfortunately, one of the things he did was get some bulldozers out there and doze that space in between just perfectly flat. Nothing but dirt. And flat dirt, so there wasn't any little depressions or anything that somebody could hide in. So when they did start coming, we saw them. They did get through, and they did get through the inner wire. And one of their main targets was the 175 battery across the street. But they did not, and they got up to it, but they did not get in and get the guns.
Did you all have sentry dog, MP sentry dog?
I'm sure they did, but right. I never dealt with them.
Okay.
No, I never saw them.
Were there spotlights or lights out there at night? Or
was mostly what you depended on was night vision devices and flares.
Okay. So, no, there were the spotlight
and not really
electrical no. thing.
Not really, no.
Okay.
Not really.
Pat, did you ever worry about fragging or hear about any incidents?
Heard about it. I never worried about it. And I don't know why. Maybe I should have. I guess I just never really thought about it very much. I think I mentioned they tried to frag my successor.
Yes.
But I really got there and left before that got to be a real big problem. It was just not something that you heard a lot about while I was there.
Right.
And I left in October 69, and, you know, 6 months later it was a big thing, but not while I was there.
Did you see? Go ahead.
We had a little bit of drugs. I had one investigation in my company. And it's funny, it's not funny, but we had one kid who was, I mean, picture the corn-fed, homegrown Iowa, red hair and freckles, apple-cheeked, all-American boy. Somebody, and I believe this to this day, put a hash pipe in his area. There is no way out, and I knew this kid. He was just a real young kid, very immature, and there's just no way I ever believed he was smoking dope. And I had a couple of guys I knew were, but mm-hmm. or strongly believed were, but there is no way I believe this kid would. In fact, when they found this pipe, and I looked and saw who it was, I laughed. So I just knew there was no way he was doing that. Of course, he was scared to death.
So someone found the pipe?
Somebody was using it and planted it in his area. So it wouldn't be found in their own area. Mm-hmm.
Who found it?
The CID. Okay. And unfortunately. But we had some vibrations, if you will, information that there was some, might be some dope there. And so CID was right next door, and so I went and got them, and they came over and did a search and found this thing. So
what happened to the kid?
Nothing. They took him over and interrogated him and did all that stuff. But
and it wasn't him?
It was not him, no. There's no way it was him. I think if he'd ever taken one puff on a hash pipe, he'd probably passed out and been unconscious for 3 days. He was just one of those kids,
one
you
of
know.
Types.
And, you know, just very naive. And, mm-hmm. But and I suspect I knew who it belonged to. But that was really the only real drug incident that we had.
Pat, on base there at Quan Loy and at Tay Nin, tell me about the opportunity to attend religious services. Was that there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had chaplains all over the place. The chaplains would actually go out in the field with the infantry companies and conduct mm-hmm. services, mm-hmm. you know, when they could. There were services every Sunday, mm-hmm. All denominations. Yeah, that was very readily available. I didn't myself participate, mm-hmm. but a lot of guys did.
Did your personal spiritual beliefs change during the war or because of the war? Or can you make some general comments on that?
No, I really didn't. Like I say, I'm not sure. It's one of the things I thought about a lot. I was pretty young, mm-hmm. Pretty naive. Not something I really thought about a lot. I can't say that I had any big spiritual mm-hmm. awakening, any you know, for or against. No, I can't really say that it impacted me that way.
Okay. What about the ideas of courage and bravery in warfare? What did you see in your positions during your tour there?
Well, you know, in first to the fifth, that was something that was always there, and you would expect it to be more of a part of the culture in an infantry unit than mm-hmm. than a log unit. Mm-hmm. It was just something that was always there. You know, the officers, the infantry guys, were always very much aware of their role and the expectations that they were expected to fulfill. Mm-hmm. And my experience was far and away most of them did it. You know, one incident that I remember, we were sitting there, one of our companies was in contact, and we had been alerted to move to reinforce them. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting there waiting for the helicopters to come in and pick us up. And there was a shot, and one of the infantry officers, lieutenant, I mean, he jumped up and was just in two steps at full speed heading for the sound of that shot. There was obviously never any thought of his mind in his mind of hit the dirt, hide, turn around and do something with his troops. He was going to get over there and do something. And that struck me at that time, and it still does. I mean, that was, I thought, just a pretty telling incident about the mindset that most of the infantry guys, mm-hmm. most of the infantry guys had. They knew they were expected to be leaders, and they wanted to be, and they wanted to fulfill that role. And you know, I understand that this is a little idealized by the passage of time. We had infantry guys, infantry officers who were scared to death and who huddled in the bottom of their foxholes. But far and away, the majority of them didn't. The majority of them were pretty courageous guys.
What happened if that incident? Did the guy find it?
Turned out to be an accidental discharge.
But it left an indelible impression, it sounds like.
It did, because of the reaction.
Yeah.
And the guy, if you'll remember a little while ago, I told you about the guy who got drunk and,
yes,
and got in all kinds of trouble.
Yes.
Was that guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Before or after?
Before.
Before.
Wow. He never went back to the field after that incident, but he was a pretty brave guy. He screwed up royally, but he's a pretty brave guy. And I think the majority of them were that way.
The officers? Or
the officers, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What about fear? Tell me about that. In a war zone that you personally experienced or that you witnessed.
You know, the worst feeling, unquestionably the worst feeling, is when you were getting a rocket or a mortar attack. Because there just wasn't anything you could do. You know, they were way outside the perimeter. You were nowhere near the perimeter. All you could do was just kind of hit the ground and huddle up and hope. You know, and that was the worst experience of all. And yeah, boy, you were scared. And, I mean, you could hear things whistling overhead and explosions going off all over, you know, and some of them close and some of them not. But boy, that was the worst experience because you were so helpless, you know. During the ground attacks, at least you could get out and put the guys that you had left in kind of an internal perimeter, make sure that they were down, that their weapons were ready, and that kind of thing. And you could at least kind of be prepared to defend yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, when you were getting mortar or getting rockets coming in, it was just a helpless feeling.
Do you think they did it to cause some psychological trauma and cause that fear?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it, sure. I think that was a big part of it. I don't think it really had any real lasting effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 20 minutes after it was over, everybody knew it was over and it was kind of business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
But every once in a while they get lucky. You know, one time at Tainan they hit some fuel blivets. That made a big fire.
Yeah.
Of course, there was the time that the sappers got the ammunition depot,
mm-hmm.
and that blew up for about 2 weeks. but most of the time, the damage was relatively minor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, but there's no question they did it as much for psychological impact. At least, no question in my mind,
mm-hmm.
they did it as much for psychological impact as to cause actual damage. Let us know they were there. They were watching us. They could shoot us anytime they wanted.
Mm-hmm. Did you, as you went through your tour and as you're approaching your time to leave, did you start to check out a little bit from the war and start focusing back on the United States? Or were you focused enough where, you know, I'm going to do this as much as I can right up to the last day?
Well, as a company commander, you're pretty focused. You don't really have a lot of time to start thinking about what comes after and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I had my replacement came in, a guy named Tom Skinner, and he's been a week or 10 days mm-hmm. with me. And then we had the change of command about 8 days before I was ready to DROS. And that was a tough 8 days because you go from 60 to zero in, 0.2 inches.
Were you still there at Quan Loi?
No, you don't leave the former commander hanging around to look over the new commander's
right,
shoulder.
You get out.
You get out. And in fact, right after the change of command, within half an hour, I was gone.
Wow.
I got on a helicopter and went back to Benoit.
Now, tell me about leaving your men. Tell me about what that was like, leaving Quan Loi, knowing that, boy, I might not ever see this place again.
Well, leaving Quan Loi did not break my heart.
Right.
But I tell you, it was like leaving family. I really had the same kind of, much to my surprise, had the same kind of pangs and emotions, not to the same degree, but the same kind of feelings about leaving the company as I did about leaving family. I mean, you get really close. been through nothing like the infantry guys, but some fairly intense experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, you live together, ate together, slept together 24 hours a day, and you get pretty close. And it was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It truly was. I was tired. I was ready to go, but it was difficult leaving my guys. It was, and I like to think that some of them hated to see me go. And I had to get a few of them aside and say, you know, listen, this is the way the Army is. And
you did have to say this.
And I expect you to give Captain Skinner the same kind of support that you gave me. And I feel sure that they did.
How was Captain Skinner? Was he respectful to you as a lieutenant?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, he was a good guy. He told me to call him by his first name. And you know, as a commander, we were kind of peers. He was a captain and I was a lieutenant. There was never any of that. He was a good guy.
How long was he around? Were you kind of training him up?
Yeah. Oh, I guess 8 or 10 days. Probably just about long enough.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you make any good close friends? Any individuals that you could look back and say, yeah, he was a good friend for me? On that personal level?
Yeah, not really. Not really. I stayed in touch with Chuck Case, my XO, for a while after the war. After I came back, not after the war, but mm-hmm. we kind of lost touch over time. And you know that as close as we were, there's still that distance.
But
the distance between an officer and an enlisted man. And
right.
Between an officer and an NCO. And you have to kind of maintain that distance. And you know, that, I mean, discipline demands it. We got pretty close, but I can't say we actually made any real close mm-hmm. personal friends mm-hmm. within the company.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about leaving. You left Quan Loi, mm-hmm. and you still, what, have eight days or so?
8 days left. And
where'd you go? What happened?
Well, I went down to Benoit, mm-hmm. and they put me up in the battalion area. And it was a pretty stressful time. I was pretty bored. Didn't really have anything to do.
Why was that stressful for you?
Well, like I said, you went from 60 to 0 in 0.2 inches. Uh-huh. And it was, you know, trying to depressurize. And Colonel Hawk came to me later and he said, Patrick, I apologize. He said, I brought you down here too soon. He said, I should have brought you down here a day or two in advance, not 7 or 8 days. But I could understand his position. Here he had a captain who had been sent into command, had a lieutenant in command who was derosing,
mm-hmm.
and it was appropriate for him to get the captain in there as quickly as he could. And I never bothered me. I never mm-hmm. thought anything about it. Just made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Still does.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a pretty tough 7 or 8 days.
What'd you do?
Sat around a lot, read a lot. Sat around the battalion maintenance operations section a lot. Didn't know enough about their operation mm-hmm. to really help any.
Mm-hmm.
People would ask me questions about what went on in the company area as mm-hmm. opposed to the battalion, and I would try to answer those. Went to the PX, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of days before I was actually supposed to get on the plane, you moved to the out-processing depot. And it's kind of interesting, too, from being a company commander and being kind of one of the big guys, you move here and all of a sudden you're just another lieutenant, you know?
Right.
And just another one of the guys going home.
Mm-hmm. How did you get out early? What happened?
That happened actually fairly routinely. They call it giving a drop. And I never had any hint of any rationale or rhyme or reason behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But I wound up going home, I guess, about a week early. 10 days early. As I mentioned, Diane and I had plans. She and a friend of hers, one of her sorority sisters, were going to drive up. Then the sorority sister was going to fly home, and Diane was going to meet me in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I mean, in San Francisco, sorry. We were going to drive down the coast. Well, I got this bright idea of not telling her I was coming home early.
And how were you all filming this? Was this all kind of from Hawaii?
No, by letter.
Okay. And the last letter you sent her was everything's a go for our plan.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll see you at Travis.
I'll see you November, God, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And because I already had orders, mm-hmm. and I just got an amendment to the orders. And so I came in at Travis, and since I was staying in the Army, I did not have to go to Oakland to out process. Mm-hmm. Once I landed at Travis and went through customs and all that, I was free. And so I went in and...
Before we go there, tell me about literally leaving Vietnam, walking out to the plane on the tarmac. What was that like? Did you see it, people coming in? You know, you remember the very first scenes of Platoon where you have the young Charlie Sheen arriving and the dust and the heat hitting him, and then you've got, you know, the bodies going out, stuff like that. You see the old 1,000-yard stare guys walking by. Did you have any, what happened there leaving?
I never saw any of that, coming or going. I went to the replacement detachment there, replacement depot, and spent a couple days there out processing. And don't ask me why I remember this, but the night before I was supposed to get on the plane, they showed Planet of the Apes.
Memorable movie.
Yes, yes indeed. And of course, we're all antsy as hell.
Yes.
All we want to do is get on that airplane and go home.
Now, you don't know any of these guys, do you?
No. They're from all over Vietnam.
Right.
All MOSs, everything. Officers enlisted, everything.
Did you talk about your experiences? Hey, what did you do? Where were you? What happened?
You know, what unit were you in? Uh-huh. That kind of stuff. Uh-huh. No real detailed war stories. Mostly talked about, man, I want to go home. Uh-huh. So anyway, of course, just antsy as hell. Couldn't sit through the movie. Got up and walked out and went to the bar and... Mm-hmm. And went back and tried to sleep, and got up the next morning, was all packed and everything, and finally they took us out to the plane. But
the bus.
We got off at the edge and walked across the tarmac, and had to climb up the stairs. Mm-hmm. Got on the plane, and real live stewardesses. And
what were you thinking walking across that tarmac?
I was thinking, man, let's go home. And I'm glad I'm going home. Mm-hmm. You know, I was ready. I was ready. Colonel Hawk had asked me if I wanted to extend. Had I been single, I would have. I would have stayed.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell him that?
Well, actually, what I told him was if he'd pay my alimony, I would extend. Because Diana would have killed me. She wouldn't really have divorced me. She wouldn't have done that.
Right.
Certainly would have hurt her.
Yes.
But there was never any thought in my mind of extending. I was just glad to be home. We get on that airplane, and they cranked up the air conditioning, and we just kind of leaned back, and we came home by way of Alaska.
Okay.
And I got off the plane in Alaska in October, late October. It was 20 below.
They had just come from Vietnam.
They had given us a field jacket in Vietnam that we would turn in when we got back to the States. And we had to walk across the tarmac to the terminal in Alaska and wandered around in there while they refueled the plane and bought the baby a present. And
what was it like leaving Vietnam on the airplane? Do you remember looking out the window, or was there an announcement by the pilot that you cleared Vietnamese airspace?
Oh yeah, he came on and announced that, and the stewardesses were talking to us, congratulations, mm-hmm. and it was a buzz through the plane of excitement. You mm-hmm. know, we were all real excited and about going and glad to be out of the heat and humidity, mm-hmm. and. And the stewardesses were just right on top of it. I mean, building up the experience and happy for us. And I guess they were a little older ladies, and I guess that they got that because of their seniority, and it paid pretty well apparently mm-hmm. for them. And but they were bringing drinks around and just all kinds of stuff. You know, just being real nice. Mm-hmm. And but it was an exciting kind of thing, you know.
I can imagine. So when you get in Alaska, you refuel, you take off, you go down to San Francisco.
Go down to Travis Air Force Base and get off. And I had a trophy weapon, an SKS. There had been a special forces unit right outside of Quang Ngoi. And they had come and asked us for some help, even though we weren't technically their support. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure they had any. They're pretty nice guys, and so we used to help them out if they need a weapon fixed or a radio mm-hmm. fixed or something like that. And so they used to bring us all kinds of stuff. And I mentioned that I had one of the pith helmets. They brought me that.
Yes.
And one of the belts and mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. And interestingly enough, one of them, one of the NCOs, got blown off the track and medevaced. And I got back to the States and I ran across him again. And he worked for me back in the States.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Well, wow. I thought that was kind of interesting. Small yeah. Army.
Sure. Were you able to keep everything?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It just took a little time to process it, mm-hmm. but there was so much of that mm-hmm. coming back. All they did was I had filled out the appropriate paperwork and they checked the serial number on the weapon. That was it. I got rid of that later, but now, of course, wish I'd kept it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what I'd do with it, but now I wish I'd kept it. But
well, you've done it to the Vietnam archives.
That's what I would have done, no question.
How stringent were they, looking through your bags and seeing what you brought home?
Especially as an officer. You know, they made some of the guys empty everything out, and I took everything out because everybody had to, and they walked by and I said, yeah, okay, you can put it back in then. And I did. And and I was Mr. Clean. I mean, there was no way I was going to get something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had also checked in Vietnam, too. All your stuff. I had an old rain jacket that I was going to bring back with me. I said, no, that's Army property. You can't take that back with you. And so I said, well, fine. I don't care.
Here's your rain jacket.
Here. If it was going to slow me down more than about half a nanosecond, I was not going to live with it. So anyway...
So Diana has no idea you're back.
None.
Did you call her?
No. And I was going to surprise her.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, this is all in the middle of the night that I'm up at Travis. Mm-hmm. And changed clothes and put my greens on, dress uniform and my new shiny new ribbons and all of that.
When were you issued those?
Ribbons?
Yes.
Officers were not issued ribbons.
Okay.
I had actually ordered them by mail.
Okay.
We used to get the Army Times and the Stars and Stripes, and you could order all this stuff by mail.
So you had them with you?
I had them with me. Had my uniform and everything with me.
You had them with you in Vietnam and to put on over there once you got back to the States?
Back to the States,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What happened was when we came in country to back up 12 months,
mm-hmm.
we had taken all of our dress uniforms, our civilian clothes, essentially everything except what they issued us
mm-hmm.
and boxed it all up and put it in storage there in the country.
Okay.
And when we got, and I got some of my stuff out, my civilian clothes out when I went on R&R, but Diana just took those home with her.
And this was, you de-rosed out of Benoit?
Out of Benoit.
Okay. So you had everything stored there,
Benoit? Yes. Mm-hmm. And, they just gave it back to me, and so I had my uniform, and I got it soon enough to get that cleaned and mm-hmm. and pressed and all that kind of stuff. And
okay.
So when I got back, I had all that, and they had locker rooms and all that. And I went in and took a shower and shaved and got cleaned up and put my greens on and took a shuttle. A bunch of us shared a limo into San Francisco Airport.
Mm-hmm.
Flew from San Francisco to Los Angeles one way for $14.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Got to the airport in Los Angeles, got my stuff, never had a problem. Nobody was ever anything but very nice to me. In fact, my ribbon came unpinned. The clasp fell off the back, and I didn't realize it had swung down. And about three people came up to tell me about it and help me fix it and do all that
stuff.
Civilians.
Wow.
You know, we hear a lot about the getting spit on and all that kind of stuff, but in my experience, there's a real reaction in the other direction. People who were trying to make up for that, mm-hmm. that anti-GI feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I had several incidents like that.
Of helpfulness.
Of helpfulness.
Past the ribbons, were there other incidents?
Well, not that I remember in this particular at the airport there and things like that. But one time when I was a young enlisted man, and the anti-war, anti-GI thing was kind of just getting started, I was going to Diana's for Christmas, and we got stranded out in the middle of nowhere, two of us, and we were trying to hitchhike. And one guy, and never forget this, in a Jaguar stopped. Right. Did I tell you about this?
I think you did.
Okay.
Go ahead.
But anyway, he stopped, picked us both up, took us right to our doorstep, wouldn't just take us in the vicinity of, I think I did mention this before, but wouldn't just take us, you know, to the town and drop us off. Absolutely insisted on taking us right to the door. But anyway, even a year and a half, 2 years later, coming back from Vietnam, I never had a single negative experience of any kind.
Had they warned you all, you know, watch yourself in the airports if you're in uniform?
No, I don't remember anybody saying anything.
Nothing like that.
But,
how about,
of course, most of the guys were getting out.
Right.
And so they had to go from the airport to Open Depot and get out processed and all that kind of stuff. So actually only a few of us stayed on. And, I mean, we're cut loose once we got through the airport at Travis.
When did you decide to stay in the Army? You said now you know you're not getting out. I mean, you're going to take care of your commitment here. But had you decided then, I'm gonna re-up and keep going?
No. Actually, the big decision maker was when they sent me back to college.
And that was that the first kind of order of business for you, was to get back in school at that
point? It really was, personally and professionally. I had been reassigned to Aberdeen Proving Ground, and which is the home of the Ordnance Corps. I went back there.
I want to hear about seeing Diana, but go ahead with. But you're going to go to Aberdeen.
Yes, and I had applied for the undergraduate degree completion program and been turned down. And I went down to what they call Branch, which is the portion of the Military Personnel Center where they maintain your records. And each branch has their own office there, and. So went down to Ordnance Branch, asked them what was going on, and they said, well, we don't have any of your OERs from Vietnam, from when you were a company commander, and I'd had two.
Right.
And I said, okay, and this wasn't unusual. It took months sometimes for paperwork to flow, and it was all paper.
And these were the good ones from Hall.
These were the really good ones. And so it was obviously, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. Go away, son, you bother me. Fine. So I went back to Aberdeen and waited. Several months later, they called and said, well, your OERs, your command OERs from Vietnam hit. When would you like to go to school? That's how much influence Colonel Hawk had on me.
Did he know that you wanted to go back to college?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had told me. He had got me in and said, son, you need to go back to college.
Really?
The handwriting is on the wall. If you want to be an officer, you're going to have a college degree. And he had said, and the battalion XO had told me the same thing. And my new commanders, when I got to Aberdeen, told me the same thing. But anyway...
What an influence this man had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean my whole life. And
did you ever get to see him again?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he gave a battalion reunion. He was assigned in Washington because it's obvious he was an up-and-comer. And so he gave a battalion reunion, several of them, in fact. And we went down. Diane and I stayed with him and his wife, Mickey, and just all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, we saw them many times. In fact... in 1984, when I was assigned to the Pentagon, he was retired from the Army, living in Washington, and we got together.
Has he passed away now?
You know, we have regretfully, we have lost touch. There's a new Army system now, AKO, where I'm going to try to locate him again.
Tell me about seeing Diana and getting there early and
I was having a blast. I mean, I was having so much fun. Took a cab from the airport. Again, to tell you how long it was probably 25 miles. Cost me $10. To her doorstep, walked up and rang the doorbell.
What time of day is this?
9:30 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And walked up and rang the doorbell.
And this is her parents?
Her parents' house.
Okay.
In Seal Beach, California, which is in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
Rang the doorbell. Her mother came. They told me this later. Came to the door and looked through the little peephole and said, "Oh my God." She flung the door open. When she said that, Diana heard her. She said she knew instantly who it was. Esther, Diana's mom, and a great lady, jumped on me. And boy, here came Diana. Mm-hmm. Zoom. Ran out and flung her arms around my neck, and her mother's arm was caught between us.
Uh-huh.
And don't ask me why I remember all this, but her mother's arm was caught between us, and she couldn't get it out. And she was like, "Oh, ow, ow, let me have my arm." And of course, we were just glommed on together, and she finally got her arm out. And we hugged and kissed and said hello right there on the doorstep and all that kind of stuff. And I said, "Where's the baby?" Baby was sitting in the middle of the living room floor, and I mentioned I ran over,
yes,
scooped her up, scared the hell out of her. She starts screaming bloody murder. So that was kind of the homecoming. Then Diana proceeded to give me hell for not telling her I was coming home. In a joking way.
Sure.
Not really. So.
Sure. Sounds like a great homecoming.
It was a terrific homecoming. After a couple of days, we left the baby with Diana's folks, and she and I did drive up the coast to San Francisco, and just had a real nice few days and did some sightseeing and stayed in a Madonna Inn. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I have.
We just stumbled across it by accident, didn't know what it was,
mm-hmm.
but stayed in Carmel and San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
just had a nice time. It was a nice homecoming.
You've alluded to this before, but I want to kind of revisit it now and then again later. Did you have any kind of problems adjusting back to the United States?
You know, very few. I am not one of these guys that had nightmares and tossed and turned. It was a little spooky driving at night.
Why?
I wasn't used to it. You know, I wasn't used to driving at night with headlights.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a little weird that, you know, you didn't have to be looking out and that kind of stuff. After I got to Aberdeen, I had a couple of nights where I had nightmares. But the nightmares were that I was back in Vietnam. Sitting there talking to Colonel Hawk. He was welcoming me back. And, boy, I was depressed. Because I was back,
right,
and in Vietnam, and I would wake up sweating, but after a couple nights that went away, and I never had any more problems. I never went through the kind of trauma that some of the guys did, and
mm-hmm.
So it just wasn't that emotional upheaval, that wrenching that some of the guys went through. It wasn't that way for me.
What about loud noises?
No, I never had any of the loud noises. None of that stuff ever bothered me. Although, I was standing on a street and a car backfired and three guys hit the ground.
Oh, really? You saw this?
I saw that. Yeah.
That was then?
Coming back, yeah. I wasn't one of them.
Did you know what the reason was?
No, I just knew it was a loud noise. Did you know
why they hit the ground?
Oh, I suspected I knew, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's really only one reason for it, but...
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Okay. So you get to Aberdeen, and you are waiting. You get the great reports in, and you're off to school. Now, were you able to pick where you wanted to go? Did you, you know, what was that process like?
I was absolutely able to pick the school I wanted to go to. I wanted to go right away. But all captains, all captains go to an Army school called the Advanced Course. And it's to teach you how to be a staff officer, mm-hmm. essentially. Aberdeen is where the Ordnance Advanced Course was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wasn't ready to go to the Advanced Course. I needed another year or two before I was ready for that.
You're still a first lieutenant.
Just made captain about probably 2 or 3 weeks after I got there, I made captain.
Really? Was that...
At that time, it was kind of automatic.
once you're back?
No. Or 12 months as a second lieutenant, you made first lieutenant. 12 months as a first lieutenant, you made captain.
Okay, I see.
Okay. And if you didn't really screw up, it was basically automatic.
Okay.
You then stayed a captain for approximately 200 years. Slight exaggeration.
You had to take yourself forward then, basically. Start proving yourself to move up through the ranks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But you had to do that every day.
Right.
So anyway, I was a captain, and but I wasn't ready to go to the advanced course yet. Well, the Army was not willing to move me to college and then move me back to Aberdeen to go to the advanced course.
Sure.
They said, you stay here for a couple of years, you go to the advanced course, and then go to college, which was a fairly typical pattern.
Were you okay with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They were going to send me to college free.
Right.
I was okay with anything they said. I tried to get them to send me right away, but pretty obviously it was a losing battle, so I didn't fight it very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed at Aberdeen. I was a company commander, once in a student company. I had the Ordnance School.
Mm-hmm.
Ordnance Center and School was at Aberdeen. So once in a student company, I was a company commander. And once in a permanent party company, which was the instructors and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They all had to have a holding company, and that was me.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the advanced course, and then went off to college for 2 years. Fantastic opportunity, just unbelievable. Full paying allowances. They paid all my tuition, all my fees, all my books. The only contact I had with the Army for 2 years was to draw my paycheck.
Wow.
And I came out with a bachelor's degree.
And the agreement was you would stay?
I was two for one. So I was now obligated for 4 more years.
And were you thinking, again, career?
At this point, I was thinking maybe I had enjoyed what I'd done. They gave me great opportunities. I was thinking, you know, maybe I need to think about staying in.
Was there
good enough for my dad, you know?
Okay. What about Diana? What did she think?
Well, she was used to the military. Her father was a career military guy.
Mm-hmm.
She liked it. She said she would have had no problem with me staying in,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Moving around. It was hard on her leaving her family. I went to school in California, so she'd be near her family. And it was hard on her leaving her family, but she knew, you know, that's the way the military is, and you just deal with it. So,
where did you go to school?
I went to Cal State Long Beach.
Okay. Before we talk about that, one other question about career and Army. Did you have any other interests that, you know, I could go think that to yourself that I could go in that direction, you know, completely not military, you know, into advertising or any other career path that interests you that you were considering?
You know, I really didn't. I was so focused on getting the degree, and I really didn't even think about life past a college degree. I knew at that time, yeah, I mentioned you had two kind of parallel career paths, Army Reserve and regular Army. I had applied for a regular Army commission,
mm-hmm.
Which if you wanted to stay past 20 years was mandatory. The CG at the commanding general at the Ordnance School had turned me down. I mentioned I had a very good time in college the first time around.
Yes.
Unfortunately, my transcripts reflected that.
Is that where it came back to get you?
That's where it came back to get me. Was I had the OERs, I had recommendations, letters, and everything. He would not recommend it be approved because of my grades were so bad.
Hmm.
I said, Dad, you were right. So anyway, on the advice of some friends, I withdrew my application.
Okay.
If you get a general officer recommending disapproval, it's a done deal. It's going to get disapproved. Once you get a disapproval in your file, it's 5 times harder to ever get it approved. So the smart thing to do was just take it back. Well,
like it had never happened, like you had not?
Like I had never applied.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
As it turned out, I went to school. And then went to another assignment. Part of the requirement for the degree completion program was that upon completion, you apply for a regular Army commission, which I did, and I got it.
Okay.
So
things just fell in.
Things just kind of started going click, 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 click.
Mm-hmm.
I went on to my next assignment. Well, I went to school. was great. Graduated.
I want to talk to you about that and your experiences in more detail, and I want to ask you about your advanced course in a little bit more detail.
Okay.
But again, you weren't really considering another career path.
I really was not at that point. And I knew that I had 4 more years to go. And so, you know, I didn't feel any time pressure or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Knew I had plenty of time to make a decision. Of course, as Vietnam drew down, promotions just came to a screeching halt.
Right.
That's why I said you stayed a captain 200 years. A whole bunch of us did.
Mm-hmm.
They had a couple of RIFs, which is a reduction in force. That's where the Army tells an officer, you're a nice guy. We appreciate your interest in national defense, but you're out. And we had several guys get ripped, several guys get passed over. You get passed over X number of times and you're out. I mean, we had guys with 17, 18 years of service. After 18 years, you were locked in. Up to 18 years, you were subject to being bounced for not getting promoted. Big guys, 16, 17 years of service. Virtually all of the former NCOs who had gone to officer candidate school and gotten commissions got ripped. Most of them reverted to their regular grade, which was NCO, which I thought was kind of a dirty deal. But, I mean, the personnel system is relatively cold. But I went through all of those. I got the regular Army commission, and only about 30% of people who applied were accepted. So that kind of told me that I was in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Our former battalion XO from Vietnam, from the 27th Maintenance Battalion, was now in mil percent. He told me I was in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
So Diane and I got to thinking about it, and we decided, well, we'll stick around and see what it's like.
My
assignment after I went to school was to Fort Sheridan, Illinois. They were just starting to put a tremendous amount of emphasis on the Reserve and National Guard at that time. I went to what was called a readiness group, and our job was to train Reserve and National Guard units. And this was in the depths, the pits of the Vietnam War. In fact, I got there in 74. And boy, the Army was not a pretty place at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the Reserves and National Guard, it was really heartbreaking. But I just really got fed up with the me first and my career and the self-promotion. I mean, every Army officer has to promote himself to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, you're never going to get the jobs you need, and you're not going to get promoted and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was a real culture, and this has been talked about before, of my career first, above anything else. And
mm-hmm.
And if I have to stomp on you to get to advance my career, that I'm perfectly willing to do that, that kind of thing. And I was pretty disgusted and pretty fed up. And Diana said, well, you know, get out. And I actually went to employment agencies and started interviewing and started looking around.
What kind of jobs were you looking for?
For management level jobs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew I was going to have to start all over again. And sure enough, the headhunters that I talked to confirmed my suspicions. I was going to have to start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I did have the degree, and as a young guy, I was fairly marketable, and they felt like they could do something for me. But I got orders for Europe.
Pat, before we go to Europe,
okay,
let me back up just a bit.
Sure.
Tell me, just chronologically, some dates here,
okay,
if you can. When you got out in October 69, you're back. When did you report, like, formally to the advanced course? Was it January, February?
Okay, well,
70 or?
Remember, I spent a couple of years at Aberdeen before I went to the advanced course.
I reported
to Aberdeen in December
mm-hmm.
69.
Mm-hmm.
I started the advanced course 71.
Okay.
It would have been, it was a 9-month course. So it would have been the middle of 71.
Okay.
I finished in April of 72, mm-hmm. started college at Cal State Long Beach in at the summer session, June of 72.
Okay.
Graduated June of 74, reported to Fort Sheridan July of 74.
Okay. Okay, very good. How much time did you have with Diana before you, I mean, you're at Aberdeen, so, but when you got back from Vietnam, did you have 2 weeks, did you have a month?
Had a month.
You had a month.
Had a full 30 days.
Was that adequate time for you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, by the time 30 days was up, I was ready to go back to work, she was ready to have me go back to work.
And did you all move to officers' quarters, the two of you?
Well, kind of. The three of us drove. We went from Diana's folks' house in California to my folks' house in San Antonio, visited there, and then drove on to Maryland.
Okay.
They told us that they would have quarters for us, so we spent a couple of weeks in a guest house and in a motel. Waiting. Mm-hmm. They had a bunch of quarters that had been enlisted quarters that they had converted to officers' quarters. Kind of. They were really crummy. Quarry housing, they called it. And they were just horrible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, God, you take what you can get.
Right.
And I certainly couldn't afford anything in the surrounding community.
Right.
So we took them, bought furniture. We had nothing. I mean, nothing.
Everything fit in one car?
Basically. Mm-hmm. And bought some furniture and settled down and set up housekeeping. And it was nice. It was kind of pretty much a 7:30 to 5 job. Mm-hmm. You know, not a lot of nights and weekends. And while I was there, what they called VOAR, Volunteer Army, came in. So we didn't even have to work Saturdays anymore. The draft stopped. They had to depend on recruiting, mm-hmm. so they were looking at ways to make it more attractive and mm-hmm. Recruit.
Yes,
recruit people is what yes. I'm trying to say. So we didn't have to work Saturdays anymore. They did away with reveille. Those kinds of things. So it. In that context, it was kind of like an office job, if you will.
Right. Tell me about the advanced course. What was that about, and how did you?
I said classroom. It was mostly all classroom, mm-hmm. And it was to teach you how to be a staff officer, and to introduce you to what was called the wholesale system, the Army in the field. Everything I had done before and up to a higher level was called the retail level of mm-hmm. supply. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like going out here to Walmart and buying something. Mm-hmm. Behind that, they had the wholesale system. Mm-hmm. And that's the part of the system that dealt with requirements determination. How many tanks is the Army going to need to buy? How many tank engines is the Army going to need to buy? And then actually buying them.
Okay.
And it's the part that's concerned with running the depots in the United States.
Okay.
The whole procurement system is part of that. And we did a lot of studying on that kind of thing. We actually had infantry tactics.
First time for you here.
Well, we've had a little bit in OCS, but
right.
not very much. They actually had combat arms officers teaching us battalion level infantry tactics.
How was that for you?
Two up, one back, put the cab in the swamp. That's inside joke.
Explain that. That's interesting.
The basic model at that time was you put two battalions forward, one rear in reserve, and the cab were your scouts.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the last thing you want to do is put an armored cavalry unit in a swamp.
Sure.
But the combat arms guys were always kidding us that we loggies were going to put the cav in the swamp. They actually put a question on the test where the answer was two up, one back, and you put the cav in the swamp. That was the actual right answer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. They okay. had a good sense of humor about it.
Uh-huh.
And so we did a little bit of tactics, but we had a very long running exercise, where we had to contract for the design of something, approve the design, and then contract for procurement.
Okay.
As a way of going through this, the learning exercise, mm-hmm. the learning process. Mm-hmm. For me, of course, wholesale was a totally new concept. Mm-hmm. I had no clue. Mm-hmm. I had been in the 2nd Armored Division. I'd been in the 1st Cavalry Division. I had no clue what the wholesale level was.
Right.
And so it was all pretty new to me. Did pretty well. I was on the commandant's list halfway through and one off at the end of the course. It was also a time when you got to know some of your peers, guys who would be elsewhere in positions of responsibility as you all advanced forward. Helped me a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Helped my guys a couple of times. I could say, well, I know John Smith. He's in NCO assignments, and I can call him and see if I can help you out.
Right.
That kind of thing. The old boy network.
Right. Okay. Was it an effective training for you to move you forward?
In terms of exposing us to new concepts, new systems, that kind of thing, yes. In terms of a lot of real knowledge, not so much. We used to joke that it was 6 months of instruction crammed into 9 months. It has been totally revamped mm-hmm. now, and the courses are now quite demanding. You do flunk out now. You can, I should say, can flunk out now.
And you guys could not?
We could, but boy, you really had to work in it.
You had to try hard.
You had to really try hard to flunk out of an Army course at that time. It wasn't a gentleman's course. We had exams and such, but boy, you really had to try hard to flunk out.
Was this, Pat, a reflection of the U.S. Army at the time in the early 70s? Because this is when, notoriously, the Army does start to kind of nose dive a bit as far as quality. People have commented over the years. Did you see this happening?
Yeah. You really could. You could see it in the quality of the soldiers you were getting. I was talking to a guy in the National Guard, the Illinois Army National Guard, when I had that assignment. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, he said, when we had the Chicago riots, he said, we were good. He said, we had a lot of long-term guys. Mm-hmm. Of course, they had everybody in the world enlisting to get in the National Guard, not knowing the regular Army.
Right.
And if they didn't measure up in the National Guard, they got booted into the regular Army. So mm-hmm. they were trying hard. Mm-hmm. But he was very sad that they had been so good and then had deteriorated so much so quickly.
What made it so bad? What was it? Was it the leadership, or was it, you said, the quality of the
recruit? I think it was all of the above. The Army got into a mode where people were looking out for their own careers. I mentioned the 6-month battalion commander tour.
Yes.
Ridiculous. Got into a mode, if I need to stomp on you to make my career, I will.
That's what you saw at the officer level.
That's what I saw at the officer level. And I think that translated on down. And if you look at the scandals that happened in Vietnam with some senior sergeants major, they didn't pretend. It was just theft and that kind of thing. I think the Army just kind of got rotten from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a rough time in the Army. Guys who were on duty, officers who were on duty and had to go through the barracks used to have to wear a weapon. They would put guys in wall lockers and throw them out of second floor windows. There were places where officers and NCOs just didn't go. It's like, the cops don't go alone to South Chicago. You didn't go in some of those barracks. It wasn't a good time.
What changed it?
A growing awareness that the Army was indeed in serious trouble. The end of the war and a refocusing on the Soviet threat. Some superior leadership. And a very determined effort by a lot of people to change the Army. For the better. And it did. The Army today is, you cannot even compare the Army of the 70s to the Army today. We have got an outstanding Army now. The kids that are in the Army now are just damn good. Mm-hmm. They're just damn good at what they do, and they want to get out there and get it done, and the standards are, I think, are back. I'm very proud of our Army now. What they did in both Gulf Wars, I think, shows. Yeah. Not that we had a hell of a strong opponent, but I think even if we had, I think our guys would have shown you what they can do now.
Nevertheless, a 100-hour war, I mean, of major action is impressive.
Pretty impressive.
Across the board.
The guy, the logistics general that supported the big sweep mm-hmm. around to the west, what had been the...
This is Desert Storm.
Desert Storm, the first one, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. What had been our deputy commander when I was a battalion commander, mm-hmm. 21st Support Command.
Let me ask you one more question about the quality of the Army. Can you give me dates of when you first started to see the decline, and then approximate dates of when you saw it, okay, I'm proud again of being in this Army. Not that you were ever not proud, but just when you saw it coming around.
I think 73, 74, it started to really decline. And what amazed me was in retrospect, was the steepness of that curve. I mean, it was like driving off a cliff.
You went fast.
God, it was just one day we're good and one day we're not. It seemed like. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it wasn't, but it seemed like. And it was a long battle back. It wasn't until, that I want to say, the late 70s, maybe even early 80s, mm-hmm. before I think we really started to come back. But you got guys like Powell in there, and we'll take 50 more of him. Thank you very much.
And you're referring to Colin Powell.
Colin Powell,
yes.
One of my personal heroes. Another guy who almost got out of the Army during Vietnam because he was so disgusted. But we really did come back. One of the interesting things, not fun, but interesting things when I was a battalion commander was many of the senior NCOs were the guys who had come in the Army in the early 70s. And then after we kind of got our feet back under us, we started getting some real sharp, bright kids in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, the Spec 4s were a lot smarter than a lot of the NCOs. And knew a lot more than a lot of the NCOs. Dealing with that was really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you couldn't let the young kids badmouth the senior NCOs, even though a lot of times they were right.
I know that provided a nice challenge of management.
Boy, it was a very difficult leadership challenge.
Were you captain or major at this point?
Well, by this time I was lieutenant colonel.
Okay, you're back.
But,
okay.
Now, and I had a stretch of staff assignments in there. To give you a little chronology, I went to Germany the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I was there 4 years. My first 2 years I was in a staff logistics job. My last 2 years I was a maintenance operations officer and a battalion executive officer. I came back to the States in 81, and I went to the logistics executive development course,
mm-hmm.
which is the Army's senior course devoted specifically to logistics. Now, it was all wholesale and national level logistics.
Mm-hmm.
Then I stayed at Aberdeen. I'm sorry, not at Aberdeen, at Fort Lee,
mm-hmm.
Which is the home of the Quartermaster Corps.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed on there, and I worked in automated logistics systems development for a while, and then I worked in force development. And in fact, we had a new concept called the Light Division, which is paying big dividends for us.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting time. I got to see some fascinating stuff. Some generals just did not believe in this new concept. The Soviets were still a threat at that time. A light division just was not going to work. Well, it wasn't going to work against the Soviets and their tanks, but that wasn't what it was designed for. We had generals resign and retire because they couldn't, and the chief staff of the Army told them, "You can't get behind this. Goodbye."
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them did. But we got to do a lot of force development work on this new division.
Mm-hmm.
Worked for another very charismatic guy, Wild Bill Flynn, who wound up as a 3-star, and deservedly so. Crazy man.
We'll talk about that.
He's a crazy
talk man. About him and this concept.
Anyway, so I was at Aberdeen. I mean, I'm sorry, Fort Lee. By this time, the guy that had been my battalion commander when I was an XO, maintenance operations officer in XO, was at Milpersen. He sent me to the Pentagon, one of the two worst assignments of my career.
The other being?
God, I'd have to think.
Okay.
Probably the readiness group assignment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I did not fit in well in the Pentagon. I didn't do poorly.
Okay, Pat. Sorry.
I didn't do poorly. I didn't do great. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't fit in well. I'm relatively proud to say. Really interesting. Really interesting. Learned a lot.
We'll talk about that, too.
After that, I was while I was there, I was promoted to lieutenant colonel, selected for battalion command.
Mm-hmm.
Went off to the pre-command course, which was 6 weeks of German language. Rough tour. 6 weeks at Presidio in Monterey, California, learning German. St. Eustache, commanding general in United States Army Europe, wanted all his battalion commanders to speak a little German. And the unit I was going to command had about 800 Germans in it. So I went off and took Diana with me.
Uh-huh.
The Army didn't pay for her. We paid her expenses, but she could sit in on my language instruction.
And then help you.
And then help me,
mm-hmm.
Which she did. Diana's mother didn't speak anything but German until she was 12 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Her family history, Esther's family history is really interesting. I mean, it's history.
Mm-hmm.
Then a couple weeks at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And then back to Germany in Kaiserslautern near the French border.
What is that?
Kaiserslautern.
Okay. All one word?
All one word.
Okay.
And which is, as the United States Army Europe goes, is the rear. All the stuff that's there used to be in France,
mm-hmm.
before De Gaulle booted us out. From there, I commanded for 2 years. From there, I went to Berlin. This was in 88. I was the maintenance division chief there, and then became the G4/director of logistics for the United States Army Berlin, which means I was the senior logistics officer for the United States Army in Berlin.
Wow.
And at that time, it was still an occupied city, technically.
Yes.
We had our French and British counterparts with the Soviets on the other side of the wall. One of the more interesting 4th of July that I ever had was a party with the Soviet Army in East Berlin.
Okay. We'll make sure to talk about that.
Yeah.
Get your reflection on that.
Interesting. They're people just like we are. How about that? From there, I got passed over for full colonel, came back to the States in 91, went to Fort Hood, came back to the States in 1990. Was in Berlin when the wall came down, another interesting time. I think I mentioned I got about 200 pounds of the Berlin Wall in my barn.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bring some of that in.
Okay.
Came back to Fort Hood, was the Corps maintenance officer. If you look up staff puke in the dictionary, there's a picture of the Corps G4. And retired in 91. Texas Tech offered me a job, and here I am. So that's kind of a short synopsis.
Yes.
I had a tremendously interesting military career. I had the opportunity to do some incredibly interesting things. you stand there and watch them chipping with sledgehammers on the Berlin Wall. You don't get to do that every day.
Mm-hmm. No.
Next time I come, I've got a couple pictures hanging in my office of that time. I'll bring them with me.
Very good. Why don't we go ahead and stop for today?
Okay.
And thank you for your time, and we'll pick up here next time.